How many of you know that George Washington was a Freemason? How many of you know if you're a Freemason, you cannot possibly in your wildest dreams be a Christian? It's absolutely impossible. And I can show it to you in their own words. So how could George Washington be a Christian? And you don't even know the slightest, teeniest bit about his real involvement in the secret societies. He founded a military order, a secret order of his military officers, the generals and senior officers of the Revolution. What's the name of that order? The Knights? Of Cincinnati, also known as the Knights of the Golden Circle. What sprang out of the Knights of the Golden Circle many years later? The Ku Klux Klan. How many of you knew that? How many of you knew that when Benjamin Franklin was in the colonies, he pretended to be a pious Christian, although he was not seen in church too much, pretended to be a pious Christian. However, he entered into a sexual relationship and a living arrangement with two different women and sired children by both of them, never married either one. How many of you knew that? How many of you knew that when Benjamin Franklin went to France, he surrounded himself with prostitutes and drank champagne almost 24 hours a day? And just reveled in orgies. How many of you knew that? You'd be surprised what some ugly old men are capable of. See, these are things you don't know because you were taught something different, and it makes you uncomfortable to hear what I'm telling you, only for the reason that you've been taught something else and you've been reared with it and you've accepted it. It's hard to let go of something that you have learned and accepted that is not true. You don't want to let go of it, because then you have to give up your comfort zone.
So, it's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news as Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And also we'll be hearing clips from Lib Dem councillor for Noel, Gary Hopkins. He's the father of Julian Assange, after the 6 o'clock news. But don't be surprised if you haven't heard his name. John Shipton has been almost ignored by the London media in this globally important case about freedom of the press. Julian Assange on trial. In an exclusive interview with him tonight, he talks about Julian's misspent youth, his hopes for the case, and the incredible UC Global case, where a private spying company revealed a US obsession with hacking into Julian's life in the Ecuadorian embassy. Also, in case you hadn't noticed, it's the 19th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks today. We hear from Arizona talk show host, former US Naval Intelligence Officer William Cooper. He was killed 8 weeks after the 9/11 attacks by undercover FBI agents. And his show from the 28th of June 2001, 10 weeks before 9/11, all but predicts the 9/11 false flag attack on America and that it would be blamed on Osama bin Laden. He, by the way, was the prototype for the doppelganger Alex Jones, who might sound similar broadcasting from neighbouring Texas, but Jones has none of the military insight except that which he's fed from Rita Katz and Mossad, and just uses his show now to bash Muslims in lockstep with NATO intelligence services. So we hear from the genuine version tonight, the Hour of the Times' Bill Cooper, predicting 9/11 just before it happened on the airwaves in the US. And they say 6 people per bubble, 6 feet apart, and 6 months between lockdowns. 10:30 until 4 p.m. on Monday, they'll be outside Bristol Council House on College Green protesting against no more than 6 social meeting rules. It's Stand Up X Bristol, and we're here tonight from Not to forget HS2, another protest movement in the movement against 5G, has a new member, the super wealthy former president of Microsoft Canada. So stand by for seeing the 5G campaign taking off. And a medieval satanic group. We've had clips from David Livingston over the last couple of weeks. Another one this week, infiltrating all the monotheistic faiths, hell-bent on privatising the earth so they can buy it up for their own private property. Author of The Dying God. We heard from him also last week, giving his view on the origins of the fake Jewish Kabbalah again tonight. And one of the world's best scholars, I think, and authors on the topic, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, really looking at the modern fascism, David Livingston. More on the Kabbalah at the heart of fake Christian America and their plan today for chaos and madness to bring about a one-world totalitarian government. Some say a new world order, the great plan coming to fruition possibly quite soon in a town near you. But to review this week's news, the local and national stuff to begin with is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
So we're going to start, I think, by going straight to Prime Minister's questions for a change. But I know you've been back at school this week. How's things there? And it's actually really lovely to see school children coming backwards and forwards from school this week for the first time for months. Well, it is, isn't it? 6 months or so.
Well, it's not quite the same. For example, there are no lunches in the canteen. Everybody's got to bring in a packed lunch, and those who are on free school meals, they get a packed lunch from the school, but nobody's got, we're not using the main hall.
So the dinner ladies, the dinner men, or whoever they are no longer being employed?
Well, I don't know what's actually happening about that, to be honest with you, but they're certainly not dishing out hot dinners.
It's interesting, isn't it, that so many things seem to have been used as an excuse to completely cut them. Surely, I mean, you can prepare food. Obviously, that's an essential service. I would have thought that should stay, but one can be a cynic like me and look at saying, in things like the National Health Service, getting rid of actual face-to-face meetings with doctors, etc., and in the education service, getting rid of school meals. This is just an excuse to cut the service.
Well, I mean, since the whole thing is that every class in primary schools is a bubble, you can't have loads of classes all together in the canteen. Otherwise, we might as well just function as we did before, and that's not happening. I'm just flagging up that certain things aren't the same. That, for example, is a pretty clear example of something that isn't the same as it was before.
But couldn't you just have, bubbles going through one at a time?
No. It's difficult enough as it is, because each class has to come in 10 minutes between each class, and the parents have to be there exactly on time, and they all have to leave in a staggered way as well, so we don't get big. I mean, basically, people used to hang around outside the school gates and chat to their mates, and that's all been, cut back. I mean, we're functioning in a very different way than we did previously.
Are we going to go back to normal when this virus goes away?
Well, in theory, I presume we are, but of course we're not back to normal yet, so there we are.
Well, the virus has gone away, although there are lots of people testing positive. Certainly it's not killing hardly anyone. I think we're down at the figures of 5 deaths with COVID-19. That is, nobody actually dying at all of COVID-19 itself. People dying with it, which is just around about the normal death rate. So there's a very strong argument, and the Stand Up Bristol People meeting in College Green between 10:30 and 4 on Monday, that's basically what they're saying, is that we've got to go back to normal. What's the problem? The pandemic's finished. It finished in June. This is their argument.
Well, it may be their argument, but I think if you look at opinion polls, that's not the majority view in this country or anywhere else.
In the US, two-thirds, I was reading this week, of people say they're not going to have the vaccine in the US.
Well, that's a different question, isn't it? I mean, people would say they wouldn't want the vaccine for all sorts of reasons.
Are they mostly, we've got 66% of Americans anti-vaxxers?
Well, that may be so, Tony, and if they find a vaccine, which of course they haven't got yet, then those 66% will have to consider whether they're going to have it or not.
Trump has said he's going to have one ready for the November election.
Well, of course, and Kamala Harris and Biden have said that's rushing it because you're not doing the relevant tests. And, of course, in other words, they've come out as anti-vaxxers if it's Trump's vaccine. So there you go.
This whole term anti-vaxxer is, I think, a little bit overused, because you can be somewhere in between, can't you? You can say, well, certain vaccines I would take and others I wouldn't.
Well, I've been vaccinated as an adult. When I first went to Russia in the 70s, we were told to take tetanus vaccines, you know, and so on. And if anybody who's travelled, like, you know, on their gap year or whatever, you go and have a series of vaccines before you set off.
I think, you know, basically people have got to be convinced that it's worth doing rather than coerced or forced into taking these things. Particularly, I mean, I worked on the Gulf War syndrome back in the 1990s, and it became clear through speaking to various victims of that that it had been brought on by all sorts of things being pumped into the soldiers all at once, which the body simply couldn't cope with. So if they'd had maybe one at a time, their body would have been fine and their immune system would be able to deal with it. But if you've got, say, 5 or 6 or even 10 different inoculations being stuck into you at once, sometimes you die, basically. Your body just can't cope with all these different diseases that you're being asked to deal with all at once.
Yeah, well, the answer to that is not to invade Iraq in 91. We didn't have to go to war. We chose to go to war. And if you're going to go to war and you're a soldier, they say take the vaccine or you're out of the army or whatever. And that's why, you know, they're not in a position to argue.
I think it was Kuwait, actually.
Yes, I know. But the point is they didn't have to go to war over that. They chose to. And, of course, if you choose to do something like going to war, like in World War One with the vaccine for flu, which led to the Spanish flu epidemic, so-called, it was because they wanted to get the troops into the front line as quickly as possible and they didn't want them to get flu when they got there, so they gave it to them. And then they found out that they were getting serious flu, but they carried on sending them anyway and kept it secret.
Well, it's amazing.
Because they wanted to win the war.
Porton Down, I mean, we had Steve Brody on here a couple of months ago taking us through his investigation into Porton Down and the government inquiry into Porton Down, which eventually, this is the Wiltshire-based Chemical and Biological Weapons Centre of the British forces, and yet the connection doesn't seem to be made with between people or by people between the idea of shoving all sorts of substances into soldiers and the potential that this can cause harm. I mean, obviously they're doing that to the soldiers because they think that they want them to be able to be resistant to things out in the battlefield, but, you know, it's not the same, is it, as injecting 5 vaccines into a newborn infant.
No, it's not. And in any case, the real problem, I mean, in relation to warfare, is that it's not actually a humanistic activity. Maybe you shouldn't be starting wars in the first place, and then you wouldn't need to rush to fill people up with vaccines, because they knew that Saddam Hussein had chemical and biological weapons because they'd given them to him.
Well, we're getting lots and lots of readings of positive cases in this country, but very, very few deaths. So as the deaths have gone down, around about 5 now a day with COVID-19, as I said, so the number of cases has skyrocketed, and the idea is to test more and more people. Now, looking at the statistics, it looks to me as if the number of cases in Britain or in wherever, Manchester, Warrington, or wherever, Caerphilly, that are starting to go up is directly related to the number of tests being done. So if you're doing more testing, you're going to find more people. So the more testing you doing, the more lockdowns you're going to have, because you're just finding people with this denuded strain of COVID-19. It isn't actually causing anyone to be ill. So it, to me, seems like a very chaotic situation, Martin, where you've got nobody actually ill and yet a whole town can be locked down.
Well, what's happening is the government's trying to make up for the various messes they made earlier in the pandemic.
And don't you think they're having a laugh with us?
No, I think what they're doing is they're trying to... They don't... What Boris Johnson and his chums do not want is a massive spike over the winter, which they take the blame for.
But couldn't there be a spike of, say, ordinary flu?
Well, there may well be, and it's going to make it much more complicated to determine which is ordinary flu
and
which is COVID.
And will it test positive on their tests? Who knows? Anyway, look, this all came up. This, according to Keir Starmer, we're not doing enough testing. 75,000 tests less than we're capable of doing a day, and yet people are being sent all over the country to places you know, many hundreds of miles away from where they actually live to do their tests. Now, personally, if someone asked me to do that, I simply wouldn't do it. I would go to maybe the next day, to especially if I'm not ill. It just seems that we've got a kind of fevered approach to this, if I can use that word, where people are being tested for something which has got no symptoms at all, and they may even be a false positive test that they've got.
well, there may be false positive tests. That's definitely possible. But of course, the problem with this stuff is that people can be asymptomatic spreaders, and therefore you need to know who those people are. And of course, at one stage, I mean, Matt Hancock yesterday was saying people who haven't got symptoms shouldn't be going.
So, is there
a test.
Such a thing as an asymptomatic spreader?
I mean, that's in what the it looks like.
Well, I don't think so. No, because you tend to have the symptoms, and then you're generating the virus with the symptoms and spread it then, maybe for 3 or 4 days. That's apparently what the normal COVID is. But if you haven't got any symptoms, then you're very unlikely to be spreading it. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions. He was talking about the 75,000 unused tests daily. That does sound like a lot, though, Martin, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And it's been largely to privatising the whole kit and caboodle.
Mr. Speaker, we all want test, trace and isolate to succeed, and I've offered my support before, but the Prime Minister is ignoring a problem. If people are being told to go hundreds of miles, something is wrong. It's got a lot worse in the last week or two. Everybody in this House knows it because they've all had constituents telling them it. And the Prime Minister talks about capacity. The latest government figures were updated last night. They show that on average, 75,000 tests are not being used every day. If there's 75,000 that are not being used, why yesterday were people being told to go hundreds of miles for a test? Why yesterday were people being told there's no capacity?
Mr. Speaker, the issue at the moment is that there has been a massive increase in the number of people who need or want tests, and particularly people who don't have symptoms. And we need, and I hope he agrees, we need to prioritise people such as NHS frontline staff, our care workers, who urgently need those tests. And as we massively increase the number of tests, it is those groups who are getting priority. And I can just tell them that actually he's wrong in what he says about the failure of NHS test and trace. Let me tell him that of those contacts that supply details, 80% are reached, and 320,000 people have been persuaded to self-isolate and to stop the spread of the disease. That is the British people ignoring his attempt to undermine confidence in test and trace, ignoring his attempt to undermine confidence, and working together to get this disease defeated.
Well, the point about all of this is that the government began the whole process. They didn't have any test and trace in place at the beginning of the pandemic. They then decided that they were going to go to their mates at Serco, who are a private sector organisation that delivers things like to local authorities, so they've got no background in medical stuff at all, and they were given the contract, Dido Harding.
Okay, so that's what came up almost immediately afterwards at PMQs.
£150 million spent on faulty masks, £120 million spent on contracts awarded to a Tory councillor, and a staggering £1 billion worth of contracts awarded without proper due diligence. Where has the money gone, Prime Minister?
Well, Mr. Speaker, all I can tell her is that there's been a massive investment in PPE throughout this pandemic, and billions of items have been supplied. If she has a particular anxiety about some particular contract, then I'm more than happy to address that if she will take the trouble to write to me.
Okay, a couple of things on that. I mean, first, it's quite interesting, isn't it? He's not sounding very confident, but she, I'm not sure who that MP was. I mean, she should be using her opportunity at Prime Minister's Questions to name specific. I mean, he managed to dodge that question quite easily by saying, oh, if she tells me about the specifics, I'll answer her question. But, you know, she could have aired it to the nation what this specific contract is she was talking about. But she just, you know, didn't see. I mean, she's supposed to be one of the top lawyers in the country. She knows that she's covered with parliamentary privilege when she speaks in the House of Commons. She can name these companies. She can name these contracts. And yet she didn't do so, Martin.
Well, you may say so. I didn't know what. I mean, you might have to listen to the whole of what she said.
Well, that was yeah, the whole. Okay, well, she said.
I take your point, Tony. She should have been naming names there.
Yeah.
But I think
enabled Boris to just sidestep the question and say, "Well, you'd like to write to me about this on the quiet." That's
but if you look at the way Germany dealt with this whole question, they had local testing which was done by local authorities and local infrastructure.
What about this whole thing?
Like GP surgeries, for example. Why aren't we doing GP surgeries as the place to go and be tested?
Exactly. But very good point. But what about this contract fraud here? Because it looks as if these contracts have just been awarded to Tory mates. I mean, one to a Conservative councillor there. This is going down the road of the sort of levels of corruption that we were seeing in Spain and elsewhere.
Well, the point is that the argument is that because it's an emergency, we can't have proper, tendering and considerations of who's offering the best value.
Due diligence.
Yeah, well, the obvious answer to that is to channel the money through the National Health Service. He knows what the Prime Minister said. He said NHS test and trace. But the NHS has nothing to do with test and trace. It should be, but it ain't.
Also covered at PMQs this week is the whole idea of council housing. We'll be talking about this in a little while with Councillor Gary Hopkins here in Bristol. But there are some that say that the council housing and the general housing being built now is so inadequate because the planning laws have been so relaxed that they're going to be developing we are right now building the slums of the future.
Kim Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Liverpool in 1869 was the first council to build council housing to replace overcrowded slums. Progress over the years has often been obstructed by this Tory government, most recently with the refusal to extend our most successful landlord licensing scheme and the introduction of permitted development rights, which bypass local control and are likely to create slums of the future. Will the Prime Minister give a straight answer and commit to withdraw these plans and return control back to local communities and prevent a return to the 1860s? Thank you.
This government has already built far more council homes, as far as I can remember, than Labour did in 13 years when they were last in office, and we will go on. You've just heard, Mr. Speaker, about the huge £12 billion investment in affordable homes that we're making this week, and we will deliver beautiful new homes across the country, building on brownfield sites in a way that is affordable and helps young people onto the housing ladder in the way that they need, either through affordable rent or through part rent schemes, which are immensely attractive. And that's the way forward for our country.
Well, what he doesn't say there, of course, is that housing is at least 10 times overpriced. So, in other words, you're having to pay 10 times what it actually costs to build a house to buy it. So you've got a massively inflated market there, Martin. But this whole idea of building slums, I look around me in St Paul's here, and I see lots and lots of these student flats going up. I don't think there's any guarantees that all these tens of thousands of Chinese students are going to be coming over to fill all those student flats. One wonders, doesn't one? Because they're all very, very small, pokey little flats where they're actually the student building that we're seeing now. Some of that may become the slums of the future.
Well, it may, and I think the whole thing of affordable housing, obviously, in the eye of the beholder, the purpose of council housing was that it really was genuinely affordable to those on low incomes. And of course, what they're really trying to do is subsidise swing voters who might get a foot on the housing ladder with a help up from the taxpayer, the same people who will then turn around and vote Tory and complain about handouts to the poor.
The irony here is that the government rules when it comes to part financing housing association developments mean that the actual size of the rooms, the quality of the build of the houses for social housing is now sometimes much higher than it is for private house builders.
Well, yes. And, as we know, the housing system in this country has been broken for years. It started getting broken in 1979. There used to be a genuine choice between choosing to rent through the council or buying a house if you felt you had enough money and you wanted to. Whereas now, of course, you have to get on the housing ladder because it's the only way to get a pension. And of course, if you don't get on the housing ladder, you don't get a house and you don't get a pension either.
Freedom of the Press is going to be in the second hour when we talk to Julian Assange's father, but we're also talking about that now. And here we've got the blockade this week. Before we hear the clip from Prime Minister's Questions, Martin, what do you make of the Extinction Rebellion's tactic of blocking the distribution of the newspapers?
Well, since the newspapers concerned are, as far as they're concerned, pushing an agenda which is, pro-climate change, It's, I mean, you know, they've been arrested, you know, they can block the road, they get arrested, they get moved. I remember all of the struggles we had over whether pickets could blockade Wapping. We used to go down there every weekend and try and blockade Wapping, and that's because all the 5,000 people have been
sacked. So you were trying to stop the newspapers coming out from Wapping?
Absolutely, because of course if you can stop them, they can lose millions of pounds that evening. So every Saturday we used to go down there, thousands of us, to try and blockade Wapping.
What, the Sunday Times? That would be.
But all of them, all of Murdoch's press was coming out of there. And of course,
so that's basically, well, you're saying all of them. That's the News of the World and the Sunday Times.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point is that on Saturday night we were able to get enough people down there to at least delay the lorries, which meant, of course, that they lost money. It wouldn't be, you know, I don't know what the situation would be now. But don't forget, 5,000 people have been sacked out of hand with no redundancy payments of any kind, whatever. And that was an industrial dispute.
What was that? Just to take us back to that, because I imagine a Saturday night in Wapping, there'd be a few people who've had a few pints, actually.
Well, what happened was they moved all of the printing from Bouverie Street, which was in near Fleet Street, out to Wapping. They sacked all of the existing staff, and they then encamped themselves around the entrances to Wapping. And, of course, in theory, you're only supposed to have six people blocking they're not blocking the entrance. They're allowed to talk to the lorries coming in and out. But in actual fact, none of that ever happened. There was actual fact lorries driven full belt at pickets, and two people were killed.
Did it achieve anything? I mean, we're talking here about the swap over from the old hot metal printing to desktop published printing as well, aren't we?
Yeah, it was a technological change, but that doesn't mean that your existing staff have to be just thrown overboard with no pensions and off you go. Basically they walked away with nothing after years of service. And of course the people who printed the Sun, the guys who printed the Sun, and nearly 100 of them, they were saying when Murdoch bought the Sun, it was losing money massively, and they all mucked in, and they eventually made loads of money for it.
There was actually another change in the way that newspapers and journalism operated at Wapping, because I remember speaking to some people who had worked in the old days and in the new days, and they said one of the most incredible things, and also talking to people who were working in the around about 2010, I was chatting to someone who's working for The Guardian, saying that the weird thing about it all was that the actual deadlines for submitting articles for the paper moved forward. In other words, they were earlier than with the new technology than with the old technology, which I find amazing. But he explained it as follows. What happens is you submit these articles, and then the subs and the editors might well change and alter them. So there's quite a lot of effort goes in between a journalist submitting the article to when it actually gets printed and then distributed late in the evening. Then in the old system where the journalists used to go to the printer, literally a journalist and a printer, the journalist would have their article there, give it to the printer. When the article was ready to be set into the press, the printer would call the journalist. The journalist would then look at a reverse version, you know, if you can imagine in hot metal, of their article. They'd read it through backwards, and the journalist got quite good at this, reading everything backwards, in complete reverse. And then only when the journalist was happy that the article was the same article that he'd originally written, would he then sign it off, and then that would go into the hot metal and be printed. So even with that old antiquated system, that was a much, much quicker, it got to press quicker than this modern desktop publishing, Martin. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, because that's because, as you say, the subs and the editors want to have control of what's in the articles. So it gave much more power to the management on every level in terms of what went into the paper and in terms of things like pay and conditions and so on.
Yeah, a massive change, of course, is you go to the colour supplements from the Sunday newspapers today. And in the old days, you used to see a lot of news, photojournalism from all over the world, particularly war zones, famine zones, anything big that was going on around the world. You'd see a whole load of pictures from it now. Nothing. It's all just kind of consumer items. So there's been big, big changes in the way the press is operating over the last 30 or 40 years. So let's have a listen now to this Prime Minister's question about Extinction Rebellion and their blockade of the print works.
Dame Cheryl.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister knows very well I have an 11-year track record of opposing HS2, not least because of the environmental damage it is causing, and have expressed my support for peaceful environmental campaigns against this costly project. Regrettably, the actions of Extinction Rebellion, who've glued themselves to trains and now tried to interfere with the freedom of the press, have tarnished the reputation of peaceful environmental protesters. Will my right honourable friend tell me what options he's considering to ensure, rather than offering encouragement to lawbreakers, this unacceptable behaviour and attacks on our democratic freedoms can be prevented from happening again, and the integrity of peaceful campaigners is not impugned?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I draw a sharp distinction and contrast between the civilised approach of my right honourable friend to environmental protest and that taken by those who has tried in vain to frustrate the freedom of the press. And again, I must say I was struck by the silence of the right honourable gentleman opposite when he had an opportunity to condemn. To answer her point directly, I do think it is important. Now, given the weight of the economic interests that were under threat, and the threat to the freedom of the press, that we look at what we can do under public order and indeed under the law on nuisance. And that is what we will do.
So he's there talking about how dreadful it is that Extinction Rebellion has stopped this wonderful free press. Martin, do we have a free press?
Well, as he said economy first, and then he said, oh, I mean free press. When somebody glues themselves to something, that is not a violent act. It can be obstruction, and you can probably be arrested for it, and you can probably go to court and be fined for it. But to call that violence is just an abuse of the English language.
Do we have a free press, though? I mean,
no, of course we don't. I mean, what we've got is billionaires like Murdoch basically allowed to say what they like and sack their workers at will, as we were talking about earlier.
We also don't, I think, have very much balance. I was listening to the World Service just before I came out here, and there was Stephen Sacker on there with his hard talk, chatting away, for example, to one of the opposition representatives from Belarus. Well, it wasn't hard talk, it was soft talk, basically saying, oh, you know, don't you think, hasn't it been so difficult working with Lukashenko in Belarus, and isn't he isn't it about time that we just had a different government, and the one that even though he was elected, that maybe we should have an exile government for Belarus elsewhere. So what we're getting is very little balanced journalism. All of the major stories that we're seeing seem to be spun one way or another, and it's almost as if, I mean, we're turning into a kind of propagandistic nation.
Yeah, well, I mean, there never was any freedom of the press in that sense. But, you know, you can say what you like, but the question is, who's going to hear you? We are sitting here paid doing this, investigative journalism.
There is such a thing as balanced journalism, where you try and make sure that you're putting both sides. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do tend to put maybe a more anti-establishment side on this programme, because we're seeing so much pro-establishment stuff going out in the mainstream press. We're trying to put at least a bit of counter to that. But having said that, in the other interviews that, you know, you'll be hearing later, for example, with John Shipton, Julian Assange's father, and the author of COVID-19 Red Pilled, James Perloff, I always trying to put opposite points of view. So the idea is, you want a broad spread of opinion, and you want to know various opinions within that broad spread. What we're getting now, it's narrowing right down, Martin.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact of the matter is that there's if we were broadcasting on FM here, we would be regulated by Ofcom, as we know, because the UK Lawyers for Israel tried to close us down when we were on BCFM.
Well, it's effectively the Israeli government.
Well, indeed.
Which Mondawise very kindly did an article about how UK Lawyers for Israel were funded by them.
But of course, the print press has always been absolutely partisan. They can print anything they like, including lies. And there is no comeback. I mean, when I was working in a school years ago in London, we had a Christmas concert, you know, with the various classes doing various, you know, shows that they'd put on. And we had one called A Caribbean Christmas. And it was an inner city school. There were plenty of black kids in the school. It was a perfectly normal thing to do. So it was a Caribbean Christmas, and it was a rerun of the 12 Days of Christmas, but it was all Caribbean Five, ripe mangoes, etc. We, little beknownst to us, the sun was sitting at the back of the room, and the front, you know, first few pages of the sun the next day is parents storm out of politically correct Christmas concert. Which was totally untrue. Nobody had stormed out. And of course, what happened is the head teacher wrote to the Sun and said, well, that's not what happened. Can you please retract? They said no. Yeah, and of course they can print absolute lies, and there's no comeback. And well, that's not freedom of the press, that's freedom to lie.
I think things did definitely change with Murdoch's arrival in the 1980s, Martin. You're talking about Wapping. That there was something like the idea of, you know, some idea of balance in the press, but it kind of went out. I think it was a big step change. I remember chatting to the former head of HTV, Louis Sherwood, this is probably 15 years ago now. I mentioned Rupert Murdoch as he was driving me along in his car. And as I mentioned Rupert Murdoch's name, he got his fist and he bashed it, or actually his hand, and slapped it on the dashboard of the car really loud, scared me out of my skin. And he said, "Don't ever mention Rupert Murdoch's name to me. That man is poison." Yeah. And there was a whole generation of media people, I think, been doing their stuff in the 1960s and 70s, who, when Murdoch arrived in the 80s, were absolutely disgusted.
Yeah, that's true. But if you go back, print press in this country and in many other countries isn't regulated at all, effectively. Anybody can say whatever they like. And what happens is the billionaire owners just push their billionaire views. And, you haven't, even when they lie, you've got no comeback on them. So eventually the head teacher in the school I was working in said, "Well, can we have a letter on the letters page saying that, you know, we didn't agree with what you said?" And they said, "No. We've lied, and you've got no comeback."
This is
and
about
the end of it.
This is, I suppose, about rewriting history, isn't it? I'm reminded of things like Stalin, you know, basically rewriting Soviet history as if various leaders like Trotsky, for example, had never existed. You know, this is what they could do in the 1930s.
Well, it's what happened in this country. I mean, if you looked at the press. If you look at the press around the French Revolution, for example, it was hardly fair and balanced. Basically, everybody printed what they wanted, and they accused Marie Antoinette of being a baby eater, and nobody could do much about it.
Well, I'm reminded of Mohamed Rafik, who died recently. We had a clip from him on the show a couple of weeks ago, and you can look up the old clips on Radio for All of Mohamed. And he was saying, Martin, I think it would be interesting to know if you agree, he said that there was a sort of period during the 1950s, 60s and 70s where, after the Second World War, people were allowed to basically a normal society, a nice, reasonable society where people got had a reasonable chance of a job. And then in the 1980s, the oligarchies began to clamp down again, making it very difficult for people to get jobs, and also, clamping down on the free press, effectively.
Yeah, I mean, it's what they call in France les 30 glorieux, the 30 glorious years. And throughout the West, there was a kind of a change in the balance of power, both on the shop floor and in society in general. But, of course, from 1979 onwards, Reagan and Thatcher smashed all of that. And we're living with the consequences now in terms of a completely runaway financial market, which demands huge amounts of taxpayers' money, the privatisation of basic facilities like water and gas, and also, of course, the creation of Al-Qaeda, who are still out there killing our soldiers, even though we train them.
I mean, the maddest thing about the privatisations that have been going on under the Thatcher era, and I did a nice RT article about Margaret Thatcher when she died, which has got a timeline. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. A timeline of the privatisations that happened during the 1980s. It's pretty shocking, and some that happened afterwards. But Margaret Thatcher was privatising all this stuff. The trouble is, Martin, that if you do that, then you stand the chance of having a basic piece of infrastructure that simply goes bankrupt.
It can go bankrupt. And the other thing, of course, is that the profiteering on the infrastructure means that if you are a real, genuine entrepreneurial startup, the price for your telephone, the price for your gas, the price for your electricity is 10, 20, 30 times higher than it should be. And that means when you compete in international markets, you can't compete, is why we've been in deindustrializing the country.
It's almost a form of sabotage of the nation's infrastructure.
Yeah, but what it is, it's made making money. This is a rentier economy. It's not an entrepreneurial economy. Entrepreneurs invent new stuff, and they need cheap credit, and they need cheap infrastructure. A rentier economy is where anything you want to do, especially if you control the monopolies concerned, it just pours money into the pockets of the already wealthy.
I've also just remembered the headline I gave that article, which RT very kindly put up there, was Margaret Thatcher and the Man in the Shadows. And that man in the shadows was Victor Rothschild. Victor Rothschild being a Labour peer, even though he was very, very close to Margaret Thatcher, privatisation was one of his things. Various things like, I mean, I think he got together with William Waldegrave, who lives up on the Mendips here still, and they were behind things like the poll tax. Now, this poll tax community charge, call it what you want, it's turned itself into the council tax. And this is a complete change from the old rate system. So, you know, basically, people who were renting effectively got free water up until this system because the water rates were paid by the house owner who paid the rates. Now everyone is having to pay, even if they've got no income at all, having to pay for water. So there was a big change, wasn't there, that happened with the community charge, poll tax and council tax.
Well, what's effectively happened is taxes have been reduced massively on the rentiers at the top of the pile, and therefore somebody else has got to pay it. That would be the poor mugs at the bottom of the pile.
So let's go and have a listen now to the leader of the Lib Dems here on Bristol City Council, because one of the things that's happening here in Bristol is a new threat to Trinity Pool. I mean, this is up in Noel Martin. It's the third time that the City Council has threatened to close this pool, even though before the lockdown it's making a profit. The Mayor, Marvin Rees, so-called Labour Mayor, is now saying, oh, it's got to close.
I don't know anything about it, so let's hear the clip, and then maybe I can comment.
Unfortunately, as well as the lack of actual housing units actually being built. The other problem.
Gary's
is
here talking about the lack of affordable housing, missing the affordable housing targets too.
It's been units at sort of any price. So we've not had the services and the infrastructure put in with the housing. And so one or two developments that have actually been happening are, you know, they're potentially going to be the slums of the future.
Also, Gary, I know you were particularly concerned about Jubilee Pool. I cannot believe this swimming pool, purpose-built, is threatened with closure again. It almost seems like Groundhog Day. As soon as local campaigners and you and the Lib Dems manage to save the pool, there's another threat of closure. Could this really be true?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, this is the third time for me saving this pool. Back in 2010, we actually had the position where because the new Hengrove facility was being built with the PFI, the Labour cabinet, who had been in until about 2008, they had actually voted for this PFI, which was fine, that was okay in terms of producing the new pool, but they actually voted in there to actually close Jubilee. So when they actually left office a year or so later and we took back over, we had to find a way of rescuing things, which we did. And in 2012, there was some investment put into Jubilee, which saved it for another few years. And then 3 years ago, Marvin decided he wanted to close it down. And we had a fight on our hands then. And he pretended that, oh, no, I hadn't really meant to close it down. That was just an administrative mistake, you know, which was nonsense, of course. And now he's doing it again. He's used the excuse of COVID, which, of course, temporarily the pool had to close, to go for a permanent closure. And has put round literature, which is supposed to be a consultation. In actual fact, it's a complete hatchet job. The community are absolutely furious. I mean, they were very annoyed 3 years ago. They're even more annoyed now, having gone through this fight, having won, to have it happening again. It's just an absolute and utter disgrace.
I mean, what is the justification for closing it this time, though, Gary?
Well, he's saying that he hasn't got any money to do the repairs, which are needed not just on this pool, but on quite a number of other pools. In fact, this is about the cheapest one to put it to perfect shape.
Well, I mean, this is basically just maintenance, effectively. You know, every piece of infrastructure in the city needs maintenance. And have they just not budgeted for any maintenance?
They haven't done it. Actually, on the PFI, where they had a requirement to pay money in, they've just paid just under £1 million to the operator because of the loss of business. But of course, with the COVID restrictions on opening, every pool would need a temporary subsidy because they can't have enough customers in to make a profit. Jubilee was actually making a profit prior to COVID. Now, of course, one of the reasons the mayor does have a shortage of cash, he's just lost 50 million quid on Bristol Energy Company. So he hasn't got a few thousand pounds, so he says, left to actually look after facilities that people in the city
actually want. I would imagine it's going to cost more than a couple of thousand pounds, Gary, to do the repairs at Jubilee. Do you any idea how much they're actually looking for?
There's nothing that's needed to be spent to reopen it now. So there's no immediate requirement for spending. But to give it a 15, 20-year lifespan, so obviously, you know, you need to spend money on making certain something doesn't go wrong in the future, would cost about £250,000. But that's a 20-year lifespan. And actually, but nothing, it said, I've seen the condition report, nothing needs to be spent on it now. But what it would need, as every other pool needs, is a small subsidy to make up for the loss of customers because of COVID.
I mean, one does wonder what people are paying their council tax for if a small subsidy can't come from that to keep swimming pools open.
Well, they're paying for Marvin's private office. They're paying £130,000 for his advisor a year. They're paying enormous amounts of money for redundancy payments for staff. They're paying for more senior staff on even higher wages. And they're paying £50 million for the Bristol Energy Company.
Well, I mean, do you think you're going to be able to win this third battle to keep the Jubilee Pool? Are you up for another fight, Gary? Are the local people there up for it?
Oh, they're certainly up for the fight, all right. And, of course, because they know that we won the last two, it's given them a considerable degree of hope. The mayor tried to present this a fait accompli. He's given up on that one now, and he's now trying to say, oh, I don't really want to close it. I want to work with you. But he's shown by his actions to be in exactly the opposite position. So we'll take him at his word. We'll say, this is what you need to do, and let's see if he does it.
So the third battle of Knowle to save the Jubilee Pool, Martin. You know, there's all sorts of questions come out of that, really. One, not least of which, is the Kevin Slocum £130,000, you know, to the advisor to the mayor, and just a fraction of that would save this pool. But it does seem that there's a structural change going on, and it's not all Marvin Rees's fault. A lot of it really is coming from central government, isn't it? Particularly hitting Labour cities the hardest, like ours here in Bristol, where we're being told effectively there will be very few or no local services left after all this austerity.
Well, that's right. And of course, most of the money that local councils spend isn't raised from council tax. It's basically comes from the standard spending assessment, which is central government's allocation to each particular area.
They used
area.
To call it the rate support grant.
Yeah. But the fact is that the Tories are now definitely decided that they're going to rebalance the every area has got what they call super output areas, which is each tiny little neighbourhood. And if you've got more deprivation, there's a deprivation index. And if you've got more deprivation, you know, more people on free school meals in school, whatever, you get more money. But the Tories, over the years, and they're now definitely going to do it, they're going to rebalance it so that rural areas get more money and urban areas get less. And, of course, that just means that Tory voters are going to get to keep their local libraries and swimming pools, and people who live in the inner city are going to lose them because they didn't vote Tory.
Well, you can almost you can almost gauge this like a little thermometer based on the rubbish bins and how much they're overflowing or not. So if you go past a rubbish bin and it's all overflowing, you know you're in an area which the Conservative government and our Labour councillor is not supporting.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's basically class war. That's what it is. And if you win the election under first past the post and you've got a majority of 80, you can lash money to a lot of that we were talking earlier about housing. They're basically trying to buy votes from young middle class people who want to get on the housing ladder. That's where the money's going. Not to take people off the streets in the inner cities, because even if you put them in a house, they ain't going to vote Tory, so what's the point?
I suppose, cynically, the Labour right will be looking at cities like Bristol and saying, well, we don't really need to do anything in Bristol because they're going to vote Labour whatever happens.
Well, that's right. That's why you need to change the electoral system, as it has been changed in Ireland, Scotland and Wales for local elections. And well, of course, that means that people, every vote counts for something. And Gary, as a Liberal Democrat, would no doubt agree with me.
I can tell you,
this.
Up in Knoll, they'll be voting Lib Dem for Gary because of all the things he's done, saving the bus routes around there. And when people do that, people actually follow it with voting for them. And then but at the end of the day, it's the main thing is the mayor, because the mayor is in control. Anyway, one of the big things, I'm sure if we had Marvin Rees, who doesn't reply to my phone calls, our mayor, in the studio with us today, he'd say, what a great job we're doing in pedestrianising the city centre. And that's something that they've been meaning to do for a long time. The idea is to cut down the amount of fuel emissions and CO2 and carbon monoxide going into the atmosphere in the city centre. And by doing that, there's been a big attempt to get rid of even parking spaces. So what we've seen now, Martin, is roads in the city which have had two lanes and now got one lane, and one of those lanes has got a whole load of bollards. I don't know if you've been driving around and seen this. A whole load of bollards put in the middle of the inside lane, so that it's been turned into a cycle lane effectively. So there's now only one lane for the cars. Now this has caused quite a lot of consternation and congestion. But anyway, I put this to Gary. What's going on with these bollards appearing everywhere?
We approve of a number of pedestrianisations in areas, and if they're thought through properly, with the proper look at the consequences, I think a lot of them can be beneficial. Baldwin Street was a very, very serious mistake. And basically, the money from government is supposed to be allowing for better cycling and pedestrian facilities. Baldwin Street had about the best of any street in Bristol. A very good cycle lane that had actually been put in at significant cost, decent pavements, and the road was a one-lane road. It was fine. And blocking that off is actually forcing traffic to go on a wide berth and take longer routes. And the problem is doing some of this stuff at a time when people are frightened to go onto public transport, and they're still, enjoined us from government to be careful about public transport, means that we are going to get gridlock in the short term. And that is, a problem that they're going to find very difficult to sort out. Things are actually portrayed as being sort of for the good of the environment, whereas that's in fact, in a number of cases, they're, to try and sort out the financial mess that the mayor's got the city council into.
I mean, it's amazing, really. I've also seen these bollards going up along. It almost seems like maybe the mayor has bought a job lot of bollards and is looking for somewhere to put them, because down in St. Werburgh's along Minor Road, a whole load have appeared along there, it was a difficult place for the residents to park anyway. But now with all the bollards down one side of the road, there's simply no space for local residents to park their cars, Gary. Is there anything that we can do in order to try and change this? Because obviously local people who've got vehicles need to be able to park at least somewhere near their home. And they can't do that at the moment.
I'm afraid this is fairly typical of the present administration. We actually, as councillors, you'd expect that we might have had some notification of this. We actually found out about the proposals the day that they were starting to enact them. So basically, I'm afraid that the mayor and his small little group do not listen to any advice. And the problem actually is that, he might well be forced into U-turns on some of these issues. But in the meantime, there's been an awful lot of waste of time and waste of money. Whereas if things were thought through properly in the first place, you wouldn't actually have that.
Now, what is the point of us electing councillors if things are just done, Martin? I mean, it's almost as if this is ruled by the mayor's office and the media. So he makes a big announcement through the media. Local councillors don't know what's going to happen beforehand and have got no chance to have any discussion about it or input. The only thing they seem to get is when something happens which is a disaster, that there's a petition set up, and then usually after a couple of months that forces a debate in the council. So democracy is being really trodden underfoot by this mayor.
It's not just by this mayor. The mayoral system was imposed by the Tory Liberal Democrat coalition, if you remember. They were the ones who wanted to have mayors.
Well, actually, it was the people of Bristol voted for it.
Well, only 14% of them. It was nothing like a serious mandate. And, of course, what's the point of, you know, I mean, basically, people didn't really want it, but we ended up with it anyway, because it was an American idea. David Cameron been over to the US, and they have elected mayors there, and what a brilliant idea it would be just to have elected mayors. And the Liberal Democrats, when they were in power, went along with having elected mayors.
It's just about centralisation of power, really,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is, and, of course, the idea is that the mayor acts like a CEO of a company instead of the leader of a political group. And therefore, you know, Marvin has the power to do all of these things without consulting councillors. Even if he lost control of the council in terms of the Labour Party losing overall control, Marvin would still have the power given to him by the Tory government. Don't forget the Tory Liberal Democrat government. He can do what he likes. I don't agree with the mayoral system. I know that Gary doesn't agree with it either, but it was his party that brought it in.
Good point. Anyway, finally, I spoke to Gary about the something which is, I think, very, very important. That is to say, the economic disaster that has been the COVID-19 lockdown. That is that where you've got massive companies with enormous monopolies doing extremely well out of this, and small businesses going to the wall.
There is going to be some very, very serious problems over the next few months. People are going to be finding themselves without work. Without means of earning a living, people have got their own businesses, those who are working for others. A lot of it's actually been, you know, delayed by the furlough scheme and the various short-term assistances. But, you know, that's not the long-term solution. What concerns me is that what some of the money that's actually been put in by government has actually been used to prop up large businesses rather than which possibly in some cases have very little chance of now standing on their own 2 feet. But there seems to be little effort in terms of investing in the new infrastructure that's going to be required. So, for example, you know, we are going to need investment into more renewable energy schemes, but I don't see much of that sort of thing happening. And some of the people have been, you know, making aircraft wings or whatever, which are probably not going to be in huge demand over the next year or two, they could be using their skills more productively for the future. But I don't see that sort of imagination either nationally or in local administration.
Well, he's put his finger on it there. The fact is that lots of the macroeconomics of the situation we are in mean that large numbers of people are going to lose their jobs because in the current setup, their jobs are no longer needed, whether they're small businesses or large businesses. And that's because we bailed the banks out in 2008. That's where the money went, folks. And that's why the money that we need a plan to redevelop the economy on different lines. And in actual fact, the Labour Party we didn't win the election because it was a first-past-the-post election.
No, it's because Jeremy Corbyn rejected the referendum result.
No, he didn't. He actually did accept the referendum result. You could argue that about Keir Starmer. You can't argue that about Corbyn. The point is that we need a vision for the future. He's right about that. But we haven't got one. I tell you who has got a vision for the future is the Chinese Communist Party, because they're socialists, unlike the people who run this country. I mean, Gary's talking about he's saying, let's not bother subsidising Airbus. Well, he may be right about that. Maybe Airbus is going to go down the drain. But why should we subsidise somebody's small business as well? That business may go down the drain as well. And in other words, we're picking winners. So we're not leaving it to the market. Somebody's got to have a plan. That plan is called socialism, and you've got to have a plan for doing things. You can't just leave it to the market. And, of course, that's not Liberal Democrat philosophy. They believe in the market, ultimately, and they ultimately believe in bailing out the banks as well. I mean, I get a bit annoyed with the Liberal Democrats moaning and groaning about all of this stuff. They went into coalition with the Tory government, which lost the country's AAA credit rating by putting too much emphasis on austerity. So they even lost the country's credit rating by doing that, which shows their economic illiteracy.
It's fair to say Gary and many other Lib Dems were not at all happy with Nick Clegg as a leader.
No. I mean, when Nick Clegg just had been elected as the leader and had just gone into coalition, if you remember, I interviewed him for this show. And I put it to him that he was going to lose the country's credit rating. And he didn't even understand the question, never mind answer it.
Yeah, well, he's another puppet politician. Anyway, talking of which, Matt Hancock this week was ticked off by the Speaker because, as the Speaker explains here, this is about a minute and a half, this clip, that he's basically running the country by press release rather than going through Parliament.
Mr. Desmond Sway.
Had the Secretary of State for Health given notice of the government's intention to further restrict our liberty to meet with one another in his statement yesterday, at least some of us would have been able to question him about it. What remedy is there for those of us who enthusiastically support the Prime Minister, but nevertheless want to restrain the government's ability to govern by order without debate?
Can I say thank you to the Right Honourable Member for giving me notice? I'm very sympathetic with the main point he makes. I accept the decisions have been taken in a fast-moving situation, but timings for statements are known to ministers. It's really not good enough for the government to make decisions of this kind in the way which show insufficient regard for the importance of major policy announcements being made first to this House and to members of this House wherever possible. Can I say to him, I've already sent a letter to the Secretary of State. I think the total disregard for this chamber is not acceptable. I know the Prime Minister is a member of Parliament as well, and he will ensure that statements should be made here first, especially as this particular Secretary of State requests statements and then to ignore the major fact that he wanted to put to the country. Not before this House is not acceptable, and I hope he will apologise to members.
So that's quite a strict ticking off there by the Speaker, Matt Hancock, specifically, basically calling him a hypocrite. He's expecting everyone else to go through him and the House of Commons before announcing things, but yet he is going straight to the newspapers and saying things like, OK, we're changing all the rules to do with the so-called pandemic, which is finished in June, saying that everyone is going to be only allowed to have six people meeting together, and they're not having any kind of discussion or debate. It's a rule by edict. That's effectively what the Speaker's saying there.
Well, do you know what I suspect has happened here? Matt Hancock didn't know what the decision was when he went to Parliament yesterday or the day before, and then he was told afterwards by Cummings what the decision was. That's what's going on here.
So how's that, you know, is it Cummings is making all these decisions, you think? And surely he understands that it's only going to cause flak if it doesn't go through Parliament first.
No, Cummings has got contempt
for Parliament. An announcement to Parliament.
Cummings has got contempt for Parliament, as we saw during the prorogation debate. They are trying to rule by decree, that's quite clear, but I don't think Matt Hancock is the guilty party. I think he's just an errand boy. He was told to go to Parliament and bluster, which he did, and then after he'd done that, they were told, we're not doing that anyway, we're going to do something else, and then he got to go back and change what he's saying, because he don't make the decisions.
Interesting. Anyway, so staying with the COVID, we had an interview last week, and I'll put the full interview up this week on our show page at thisweek.org.uk with the psychological warfare officer, Scott Bennett. And here, Martin, and it'd be interesting to see what you make of this, is he thinks that the whole COVID business has been a psychological warfare operation. I suppose he would say that, being a psychological warfare officer. And that actually it's been an enormous blunder, in that the World Health Organization, the Gates Foundation, etc., have really overstretched themselves.
They've grossly overstepped their bounds. This is a push towards fascism and a testing to see how people respond. Megan Whitmer of Michigan, shutting down football, shutting down churches, arresting people who go into congregations and these sort of things. The same thing being done in New Jersey by Murphy, the governor who shuts down a gym and throws the men in court and tries to imprison them for opening their gym. The attorney generals and the attorneys that prosecute hairdressers who have to work to feed their children, they're thrown in jail and go through the court system. This is what revolutions are made of. This is the substance of civil wars. This is the ignition for both revolutions and renaissance. And I think I would like to think that we're on the verge of a renaissance, because there are more intelligent people who value their freedom and their independence and have critical thinking and go, you know what? I have not been sick. My family hasn't been sick. If I did catch a flu, Maybe I took propolis, oregano oil, vitamin C, and maybe hydroxychloroquine if it was serious, but I'm not losing my teeth or going blind or melting into a zombie. So this claim of otherwise is all propaganda.
So that's Scott Bennett. Martin, he's really making quite an extreme point of view there and saying the whole thing has been a psyop. Yes, there obviously have been some people die, but that's now completely finished. This is now becoming just an exercise in trying to control people.
Well, he's a psychological warfare officer, not a doctor. That's the first point I'd make. The second point is the Chinese Communist Party treated it as a biological warfare attack on them, which I think it was. And the purpose of a biological warfare attack isn't to kill everybody, it's to wreck the economy. But the Chinese economy is bouncing back because they haven't got any issues with COVID
anymore.
Well,
the idea is if you have a lockdown, you're going to wreck the economy. And there's a lot of people saying that there was no need for a lockdown, not least of which is the Swedish government. Now, they're not known for their reckless attitude. They've thought this through. And I just noticed last week that their chief epidemiologist has just been promoted to a top position in the World Health Organization. So it's not as if the international health people don't recognize that what Sweden has done is an intelligent response.
But in Sweden, you're still not having any football and no meetings of people more than 50. What they said at the beginning is we're going to have a limited lockdown because we're going to be able to sustain this as long as necessary. What we had in this country is no lockdown at all, followed by a complete lockdown, which was no use because the horse had already bolted. In China, even where this supposedly started, they treated it as a biological warfare attack from the get-go. They've had less than 5,000 deaths. We've had 50,000 deaths in this country, much smaller country.
You talking about biological warfare attack, this is exactly what I put to Scott, the $64,000 question of whether COVID is man-made or not.
What about the $64,000 question about COVID-19? Is this a man-made virus or is it naturally occurring? No one really seems to have actually answered that one yet.
I think it's man-made, of course. I think when you look at the scientific analysis of it, the medical analysis, the characteristics are not consistent with a natural virus. They are more characteristic of a AIDS hybrid sort of a virus. So, again, I think that needs to be examined and looked at. But the overwhelming evidence that I've seen is, one, this is man-made. Two, did it come from Wuhan or did it come from North Carolina in a military weapons depot? Why does Dr. Fauci, this guy who I think is really a criminal and is being exposed increasingly as a fraud, why does he have photos of him in very dubious places with Barack Obama? Why is Fauci predicting pandemics like this back in 2017? Why is he predicting, I think it was in October, November of 2019, before this all came out, using language that was very suspicious and seemed to indicate that a pandemic was inevitable and it was coming out? Why does Dr. Fauci and Bill Gates have photographs of each other standing and joking and all sorts of jocular interactions? Why is this vaccine and the wearing of masks and the elimination of handshakes and all sorts of other draconian human alteration of relations, why is that being pushed? I think it is a psychological operation to break people down, to dehumanize them, and using a virus is the easiest way because the average person, Tony, is not attentive enough or smart enough or has the gumption or the moxie or the energy to challenge what is being told to them. You see it all the time. 70% of human beings don't challenge what they're told. And here's the other failure you're seeing in the churches, the religious establishments, which are supposed to be representing and defending the spiritual and the moral and the freedoms and the liberties of human beings and their rights in America, the American churches. They've all surrendered. They've all put up their clothes for business sign. They've all bought into, we do what the government tells us. Well, when the government becomes a draconian fascist propagandistic machine run by algorithms and big tech psyop communities, you can't trust anything that's given to you. And yet the American churches have been totally silent and totally imploded in submission to this hysteria.
That's a pretty comprehensive takedown of this. He believes it's a psychological warfare operation, Martin. Why don't you?
I think it's a biological warfare attack which leads to a psychological warfare operation. As we know, the Times of Israel told us that the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States warned the Israeli Defense Forces in November 2019 that a pandemic was coming out of China. How did they know? Because they probably seeded it. As he said, it probably came from North Carolina. The purpose of this is because there was a crash in the stock market in September. The repo market started to collapse just like in 2008. And if they had to turn around and say to the people, we're going to have to bail the banks out again, there would have been a scream of fury. But in actual fact, if we've got a pandemic, they can bail the banks out, and it just looks as if they're doing it because of COVID.
I mean,
and of course, the other thing is to try and stop the Chinese taking over the world economy, which is what they're preparing to do.
Well, that certainly seems to have been a big effect of this. It's stopped the Chinese in their tracks, apparently.
Their economy is bouncing back now because they treated it as a biological warfare attack, and they've managed to squeeze it out of the system. So their ships, for example, if there's any fighting in the South China Sea, are completely COVID-free. That's not true of the US Navy.
Well, it'd be interesting to see whether there's any truth to that. You know, if you've got some parts of the world's soldiers, and I imagine that the people making vaccines will be thinking, well, we must get into the soldiers first. I mean, that seems to be, you know, if there is any fighting goes on, you want to make sure your soldiers are not going to get hit with some sort of COVID thing.
What is interesting is that both the Russians said that they had developed a vaccine, or that they're about to test it. And then the US puts sanctions on the facilities, which are government owned in Russia. So they're not doing it for private profit. And they were prepared to announce what they'd done. And they said, we're happy to share this with everybody else. And then the US government put sanctions on the laboratories which had developed it on the grounds that they were chemical warfare and biological warfare.
What do you make of what he was saying about the church there? Because, you know, what he's saying is that there is a spiritual element to this. The idea is it's an attempt to isolate people. I mean, that certainly happened for elderly people who've been dying in care homes. I mean, this is barbaric, leaving people to die with no contact whatsoever with their family.
Well, I mean, the situation is very bad in all sorts of different ways. If it's a biological warfare attack on the Chinese, which they've thwarted, it's quite likely that we're going to end up at war.
What about this, the human side of this, though? The barbaric side of leaving people to die with no contact with their family?
Well, I totally agree.
This has never happened in the history of humanity.
Well, no. I mean, you'll find that in previous pandemics, and don't forget, pandemics were used, because of modern medicine, people got used to the idea that pandemics don't happen.
So you think this is normal, then, in a pandemic, for someone to be told, you're just going to have to die on your own in a hospital bed with your family see you?
Listen, back in the day, people didn't die in hospital beds. They died in the street. What used to happen in pandemics, and there was many...
You were avoiding the question, aren't you? Elderly people dying with no family anywhere near them. This has never happened before.
No, it has happened before. That's why I'm not avoiding the question. I'm trying to point out that it has happened before. Previously, what used to happen in London and Bristol when we had pandemics is people were nailed into their own houses and they weren't allowed out at all. They were left to die. And that was the way you dealt with it. And of course, modern medicine, there's some attempt to try and help people. In the past, they didn't even try and help. They just made sure that they locked the gates. And people who were inside were banged up in their houses, and they died in the houses. That's how it used to be dealt with.
So this is a bit of a medieval way to deal with
this. Well, I'm just saying that's the way. That's what used to happen
for a so-called pandemic where it hasn't actually killed anywhere near as many people as the flu did in 2017.
Or in 1918,
it's completely different. Hang on, the figures are completely different for the Spanish flu and the flu in 2017-2018.
The point about this, if it's a biological warfare attack, Tony, is it's not designed to kill loads and loads
of
people.
And the point about it, Martin, if it's a psychological warfare attack, is that the idea is to isolate and confuse people.
Yes, and therefore allow them to bail the banks out and try and wreck the Chinese economy. So they've got two goals. Wreck the Chinese economy. They've failed in that one because the Chinese were too smart. And the other thing is to make people feel that there's a massive pandemic going on so that they can bail the banks out. That's what's going on here.
Okay, well, the one person that is very interested in the spiritual side of things, and I came across him here in Bristol City Centre, is Sean Miriam O'Sullivan. He's what he calls himself a street preacher, and quite often you see people preaching in the streets and people are kind of walking past, whereas Sean have managed to attract quite a big crowd. I'm talking about maybe something like 40 or 50 people in Broadmead, and they were listening to him. Most of the people were listening to him. In fact, he was even getting a few rounds of applause from people, and he was having a few disputes with people who were saying, oh, don't be silly, there's no such thing as God, etc. But when he was preaching down in Swindon a few months ago, he had an altercation with a Muslim. And so let's have a listen now to Sean talking about an upcoming court case that's going to be taking place next year. I spoke to him a few weeks ago about what is at the nub of this case.
So I was out preaching the gospel. I said, Jesus Christ is the way.
This is in Swindon.
This is in Swindon. My family came with me. My wife went out and handed out some tracts on the other side. So I was talking about Jesus. People don't want to just set things. So they want to know why. So this woman said, you know, Muhammad is the truth. So I gave her a story like Jesus talked in stories. So I just used the life of Christ and what Christ went around doing. And I shared, what Muhammad did, and I said, today, would you find him not guilty or not guilty? And she wouldn't answer the question. But the police turned up, and they arrested me without warning. They didn't tell me to stop. The crowd wasn't even arguing. Actually, when I got arrested, the crowd was saying, this guy's done nothing wrong. Why are you arresting him? And it was really, the officer looked very shocked. When I got to the police station, they read out my charges. He didn't look very happy, but obviously he's not going to shame his colleague. But yeah, pray for me, because my trial's coming up. We're looking for anyone that wants to come there, who believes in freedom of speech, to come out and be a voice and be heard.
We kept him for 12 hours and yeah. Then released in the middle of the night.
Yeah, I was in there for 12 hours, and my son was very young then. He was a premature baby. He died on arrival. He's resuscitated. And my wife was on life support machine, and my son was on life support machine. So my son needed special formula milk. He was only supposed to be gone for 3 hours. And I did tell the police this many times, that I need to get to my family. But they said, okay. It was very, very heartbreaking for me. I had to walk 10 miles in the rain, and I felt such a failure to my family. And I was really ashamed of the police force for doing that.
But I mean, surely it's bound to be offensive to a Muslim to say to their face, Muhammad is a false prophet.
Yeah, of course it is.
I mean, it's like someone saying to you, Jesus is a false prophet.
Yeah, and people say that every single day. But, you know, we do have a freedom of speech in this country. But this person was mocking Jesus Christ as well. They were saying really rude things. They asked me the question. I gave them the question. I don't go out there and shout, Muhammad is a false prophet. If they ask me a question, I will read, I will tell them things that's in the Quran and in the Bible.
Well, hang on a minute, because there's nothing about Muhammad in the Bible. I mean, that's hundreds of years after the Bible.
Yeah, he's in the Quran. So I read out the Quran, and I shared some things. I always do many times, because people want to know. They say that Muhammad was more peaceful and loving than Jesus.
So can you just sum up, what are you being actually charged with?
Racism and offending someone.
So that's Sean Miriam O'Sullivan. His trial's next year sometime. I was chatting to him earlier this week. Martin, this is a bit of a difficult one, isn't it? You know, you could say Buddha is a false prophet. You could say Moses is a false prophet. Is that freedom of speech, or is that offensive?
I would argue that people should be able to say whatever they want to say about this. It shouldn't be a matter of for the courts if people want to argue about religious things.
You're talking about offending a protected group, effectively.
Well, I mean, if you...
Say, for example, Moses. If you're saying Moses is a false prophet, that could be construed as anti-Semitic, for
well,
example.
Well, it could, yeah. I mean, the thing is, there's having a legitimate religious dispute, and there's, you know, using language likely to cause a breach of the peace because you're being very offensive, you know. And there are limits to freedom of speech. We all know there are. We're not on Ofcom now, so I could swear and about anything and so on. But I generally don't, because, you know, there's no reason to provoke people if you don't need to. And basically, freedom of speech if we're going to have anybody saying anything, then it's got to be absolutely anything. And if it's not going to be absolutely anything, we've got to have some rules about what is and what isn't acceptable.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? We had John Wesley, people like that, you know, here in Bristol, giving their sermons as...
And they used to be attacked by people who didn't agree with them. We used to throw bricks at them and so on.
Well,
totally wrong.
In which case the police would and should... You know, be intervening.
Well, that didn't
like
happen
that.
At the time. Wesley's people, the landowners and the bosses, didn't like him preaching in the street, and they used to bring gangs of thugs along to prevent him. So the new rooms where he used to preach has got no windows on the ground floor, because the people who didn't like the Methodists used to come and chuck things at them, and therefore they didn't want windows on the ground floor.
So
there's this kind of thing. People tend to have quite strong feelings about religion, which is why. There are some rules about what you can and can't say in public, because it's a public order thing. You know, if everybody's going to start screaming and shouting at each other, it's going to turn into a fight like this in Birmingham.
You know, maybe Ian Paisley in Bristol City Centre could ruffle a few feathers. But ultimately, saying that Mohammed is a false prophet, do you think that the police should arrest someone for saying that?
I think that's a legitimate dispute, a religious dispute. He might say that, and the Muslim view would be different, but then of course it would be, for obvious reasons.
So if you want to see Sean Miriam O'Sullivan, I will put a link up to his, I think it's a Facebook page he's got or something, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And also, of course, you may just bump into him if you're out shopping in Bristol City Centre. This is the sort of thing, Martin, which I suppose... The lockdowns, the pandemic, is almost bound to bring people like this out. And what impressed me more than anything else was that actually had an attentive crowd for a change.
Well, I'm all in favour of people going and speaking in public about what they believe. I've done it many times myself, and I think it's a perfectly legitimate activity.
Well, we're going to finish off the first hour with listen to a chap called James Perloff, who I interviewed earlier this week. Now, he's brought out a book all about COVID-19. It's called COVID-19 Red Pilled.
My name is James Perloff, P-E-R-L-O-F-F. I've been a journalist since 1985 when I started writing for the New American Magazine. And I guess you could say that I've been red pilled since 1978. When I read Gary Allen's book, None Dare Call a Conspiracy. I've written a few books over the years, such as Tornado in a Junkyard, The Case Against Darwin. I've written a primer on the New World Order called Truth is a Lonely Warrior, which came out in 2013, and that was supplemented by a book last year called 13 Pieces of the Jigsaw. And I was working on a book on 9/11, but got diverted by the urgency of this COVID crisis, which is really, they're using it as a pretext to bring on the New World Order very, very fast. So I do have a brand new book out. It's called COVID-19 and the Agendas to Come Red-Pilled. Part four of my book is called The Deep State's Endgame, and deep state being one of the words used for this oligarchy. But I have a chapter on population reduction, a full chapter on Bill Gates and all the stuff he's up to. I have a chapter on the... plan for global vaccination. I have one called 8 Reasons Why We Don't Need a COVID Vaccine. I have one chapter just on hydroxychloroquine, because so much has been done to try and stop the use of hydroxychloroquine, which threatens the need for a global vaccine. I also have a chapter on the plan for a global digital ID. We see Microsoft allied, for example, with the Global 2020 Alliance to establish a universal global ID, and also a cashless society. The journal Euromoney recently had an article where they're saying that COVID was making cash unnecessary in many countries, because after all, you know, money could have the COVID germs on it. So why do we need to have cash in the first place? But that has also been integrated right now in West Africa, where you see the Gavi Alliance, the Bill Gates Vaccine Alliance, is working with MasterCard and a AI company called Trust Stamp, so that people will have a digital record, not only of their vaccination record, but their financial record. And that really brings, again, to the fore the whole idea of a mark of the beast, where you can't buy or sell unless you've got the mark. And in that section, I also have a chapter on contact tracing and the surveillance state.
Well, one word you mentioned there, Bill Gates. What do you think his role is? Because he comes across as, quite an affable, benevolent chap, even though, of course, he's one of the richest men in the world. What's Bill Gates' role in all of this?
Well, he seems to be the chief spokesman for what the agenda should be. He appears throughout the mainstream media, especially here in America. And he's been involved with a lot of bad things. One thing I noticed about Bill Gates is that he doesn't like anything natural. In quoting the mainstream media, you know, I point out that he's got his Gates Foundation has got 5.3 million shares of Crown Castle, which is a 5G infrastructure builder. He's invested in half a million shares of Monsanto, now owned, of course, by Bayer, but they're the makers of glyphosate, which very carcinogenic, as well as GMOs. And, you know, you're talking about transhumanism, the transspeciesism, you know, GMOs are changing the way seeds are made. And also he's producing lab-grown meat to replace the meat that we eat. He's investing in artificial breast milk for babies. And he's even got a plan, this is in the British press, to block the sun reduce the sunlight with millions of tons of dust being spread in the atmosphere. So he doesn't like anything natural, whether it's in nature or the human body or food. He hates it. And yet he's the one, he's stated that he's invested in 7 COVID vaccine factories. One of them, of course, is the one I mentioned, Moderna, which is making this mRNA, this transhumanizing vaccine. And he is at the forefront of this drive to change the world and bring about this cashless digital ID mandatory global vaccine state.
He's obviously a very pro-vaccine guy, but you say you've got a chapter in your book all about, was it 8 reasons not to have a vaccine? It'd be very interesting to hear. Can you just run through those? Because for most people, they think that if there's a pandemic around, a vaccine is the obvious thing to do, but you don't agree. So why don't you agree?
Okay, well, all right, the 8 reasons. First of all, Stanford University did a study that showed that the maximum death rate from COVID is 0.2% would be 99.8% survival rate. But the CDC back in May said the death rate from COVID is only 0.26%, which means you've got a survival rate of 99.74% without a vaccine. So why should we have a mandatory vaccine if it we can survive so well without it? Plus the fact that the coronavirus keeps mutating. I quote an Italian nanopathologist named Stefano Montanari. He says if he proposed a coronavirus vaccine as a student, he'd been kicked out of class because the coronavirus keeps mutating. That's why we never get immune to the common cold, and that's why we've never had a vaccine for the common cold. It keeps mutating. So if you do make a coronavirus vaccine, you're going to need a new one every few months because it keeps mutating. But reason number 3, there are a number of epidemiologists, including some I quote from Oxford, that say that the coronavirus is basically COVID-19, as we know it, is disappearing or disappeared already. Number 4, we already touched on the fact that countries like Sweden and Taiwan have flattened the curve without a vaccine. Also, number 5, I quote Dr. Richard Bartlett of Odessa, Texas, who's had 100% success treating COVID with inhalers or nebulizers. Number 6, Northwestern University in the United States has shown there's a significant correlation with COVID death and vitamin D deficiency. In other words, if you're not vitamin D deficient, you're very unlikely to die from it. Number 7, we've already gotten into, but the very fact that these DNA, mRNA vaccines are changing your DNA, this has never been done before. We've never had these before. They're entirely experimental. Why would you want to mess with your DNA when we have a 99.74% survival rate?
Because they're not experimental. Yeah. They're doing proper trials on them first before releasing them to the public.
Well, Dr. Carrie Madej, who I quote in my book, would disagree with that. She says that you should be doing animal trials first. That's the standard process. But they're going straight to humans, and they're having a lot of failures, by the way. A lot of people having severe reactions from these. And since the coronavirus appears to be disappearing and we have such a high survival rate, why would you want to, as the White House puts it, bring about a vaccine at warp speed? That's how they've been putting it. The other thing is that when they tried to develop a SARS vaccine, and SARS is, according to The Lancet, is 79% genetically similar to COVID, they got a terrible reaction in the animals. They had a very robust antibody reaction, but when they encountered the real virus, the actual virus, they went into cytokine storm, which is what makes COVID so deadly for a few people. They were not cytokine storm, an autoimmune reaction in the lungs. So again, these are 8 reasons. That's not even including hydroxychloroquine, which I devoted an entire chapter to. But those are some of the reasons we certainly don't need a COVID vaccine.
Also, you've hinted here and certainly in your stuff about the Bible, etc., intelligent design. And you know, we're looking at people like Gates, basically in the transhumanists, saying that human beings can be genetically engineered to make them better. You're arguing, and I think I would argue too, that actually we're created in a rather fine fashion anyway. And a lot of this tinkering is likely to lead to actually worse outcomes. For example, through genetically engineered crops, we've seen the Terminator technology coming in so that every person who's growing food has to go to some crop company, one of the massive ones, I imagine, in order to get the seeds. They cannot grow their own seeds because everything that starts to grow is then infertile. So there is definitely a dark side to this genetically engineered way of doing things. I wonder, though, if for someone coming at this who hasn't really had much of a discussion, even at school sometimes, about the idea of intelligent design, what would you point to say, well, actually, here is some real evidence that points to intelligent design that you probably haven't ever been exposed to in school?
We are marvelously designed. We have a tremendous immune systems, and I wrote a book in 1998 called Tornado in a Junkyard, which so many things come out of Britain, whether it's Marx or the Beatles or Darwin. But Darwin's work was actually a house of cards. Certainly there's such a thing as natural selection, but you won't get one type of animal macro evolving into another type. That's all speculation on Darwin's part. You certainly, God gave us smart genes, which enable us to adapt to our environment. So a mother can, if she has a premature baby, her milk will adapt to that situation and give the baby the right enzymes and other nutrients it needs. And you know, if we have an infection, our body produces more white blood cells. We can adapt to a situation, but we don't adapt from fish to people. That was Darwin's basic mistake, was saying that we make these gigantic leaps of evolution, for which he had no evidence for. But yes, we are marvelously designed, created in God's image as human beings. And again, this is going back to what we said before. This is not something to go into my book, COVID-19 Red Pill, because it's just I'm not trying to hit people with things that are a little too spiritual. I'm just trying to stick with the facts and the quotes from the scientists. There is definitely a transhumanistic aspect to this that we want to stay away from. We want to stay away from the types of things that we've seen occurred in the past.
Okay, the other thing which I think many people will recognize, James, 100%, is this push towards a cashless society. Why should we be concerned about that, though? Because it's a lot more convenient to wave a little credit card or your hand, a microchip in your hand, in order to pay for something, than it is to go through cash and withdraw it from the bank. It means it's actually a hell of a lot more convenient.
Well, the problem is that it's very easy to take it away from you. You know, we went from here in America, we had gold and silver coins, and then in 1933, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, at the behest of the bankers, did away with that. He forced everyone to turn in their gold and silver, and then lo and behold, he about doubled the price of gold after everyone had turned it in, which is very pleasing that the bankers had got hold of it. Some people say that Fort Knox is empty of gold, and I've even talked to soldiers at Garda who say that that's privately known. But we went from gold and silver to paper money, and then we went to digital currency. The problem with digital currency is when your entire life's work is represented by nothing but a few digits in an online bank, it's very easy for some government bureaucrat to just erase that. We see that I'll give you an example. I was on a podcast. Well, I take it back. I was talking to a podcast host over dinner the other night, and he told me about a friend of his who was in China who was caught jaywalking. This is quite recent. And the way he was caught jaywalking was through facial recognition. And then the penalty of jaywalking was digitally removed from his account. Now, with the totalitarian governments, you can see how they could use this system to bankrupt you overnight. If your wealth is represented by not by real money, but by just this cashless system, they could take it away from you just like that. You know, like in China, where the social credit scores, you know, if you have a good social credit score, you're a good boy or girl, you obey the government, you'll be able to travel, you'll be able to do things, you'll be able to shop. But if you're not, they'll take that away. So the risk, in spite of the, there's always going to be, you know, sure there's convenience. To get a mouse into a trap, you've got to put cheese there. And so the cheese is the convenience. But the fact of the matter is if you make everything cashless, the government, these governments, which as we can see the evidence that they're turning increasingly police state-like, Orwellian and totalitarian, they can take away your wealth with a few keystrokes. And that is something we certainly don't want.
So that's James Perloff there, author of the book I'm holding in my hand here, COVID-19 and the Agenda to Come, Red Pilled. Martin, he talks about all sorts of different aspects there, but I wonder if you could just address this one. He actually thinks that this is against intelligent design, that you're saying that actually we are well made. Human beings don't need all these RNA vaccines and things like that. That by working with our natural immune system, that's a better way, a better approach. I suppose, generally speaking, this is the kind of approach that the Swedes have taken.
Well, I don't think the Swedes are in favour of intelligent design because they didn't have a lockdown.
No, I'm talking about working with the human immune system rather than trying to have a vaccine or some technical solution.
Well, as he said there, the book he's written about COVID doesn't really have much about intelligent design in it. We can address intelligent design if you like, because obviously he's a believer in intelligent design. We've had this debate before. I'm not. I actually believe we are evolved from fish. I'm sorry. And that's the mainstream view of mainstream biology, I'm afraid.
Okay, what about China then? Because he's saying this is, and I suppose this is a harder, more specific point, is that if we're moving towards a cashless society, then as happens it now in China, you don't have anything of value. You just have a kind of social credit score, and it can be removed at the drop of a hat.
Well, that is the Chinese system. And before they had modern technology, they had all sorts of other mechanisms for keeping people in line, you know, struggle sessions, etc. It's a communist setup. I think what's very interesting in the cashless society thing is that Narendra Modi in India get rid of cash, large note cash. And of course in India, which is a very much less developed society than China in many respects, lots of people haven't got bank accounts, lots of people haven't got electricity. So the idea of bringing in getting rid of cash in India was absolutely disastrous and caused all sorts of problems for small businesses and poor people in rural areas.
Oh, and helped all the big businesses, that's funny.
Well, indeed, yes, and it was actually pushed through by USAID, which is a front for the US deep state. And Modi,
well, it's a State Department, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's basically the USAID is supposedly helping people, but it's basically using US taxpayers' money to push an agenda. And they were the ones who wanted India to experiment with having no big notes of cash. And Modi at the time said, well, we're trying to get rid of corruption, etc. But it actually caused a massive shock. And lots of small businesses which relied on cash poor people who didn't have bank accounts were severely affected. And eventually they had to row back on it. China, on the other hand, is a more developed country than India, largely as a result. I mean, and of course, before modern technology like the social credit scores that they've now got, basically, the Chinese Communist Party used to control things pretty tightly anyway. They always did, and they still do.
Anyway, there's another chapter. Chapter 23 in this book is about the global digital ID. Now, this is a deadly serious part of all of this. That is to say, effectively, you're not going to be able to go back to normal until you've got this digital ID. It's a kind of vaccine passport.
Yeah, I think they want digital ID, and they want the vaccine people are pushing a digital ID because they want digital ID anyway.
This is a bit like the ID card struggle we had with Gordon Brown, isn't it?
It is, except it's more pernicious because
it's global too.
Yes, and it's actually something that you can't, you know, you can throw an ID card away or forge one.
We're going to have
you can't forge a chip that's inside you, can you?
Well, if it's inside or outside, that's another question, but The idea is really that this is going to be a global system and that we will not be able to do basic things like travel. Now, this almost seems as if China has been used as a template here, and the template that they've got in China, which is what this social credit does, it doesn't allow you to travel unless you've got a good social credit score, is being rolled out right across the world.
Well, I mean, in many ways, the Chinese communist system is a bit like feudalism. You're not allowed to change. For example, they didn't have a big rush into the major cities because people basically have to stay where they were born unless they've got a permission to move. And you could say that's a terrible system, but in many ways, it's actually worked for China. They haven't got massive slums in their major cities as they have in Brazil and elsewhere.
Well, just being able to travel doesn't mean to say you're going to create a slum, does it?
No, but the point is that they've got a much more controlled system in China. They always did, even before the Communist Party took over.
Yes,
they had a more controlled system.
I noticed
that's part of their culture.
In other parts of the world, that the Chinese are very much into wearing masks, which now also seem to have spread over here. But anyway, the full interview with James Perloff, which includes, I thought, a fascinating excursus into the idea of genetic engineering being discussed in the pseudepigrapha of the Bible, things like the Book of Enoch, Jubilees and things like that. I found absolutely fascinating. I'll put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So it's a 45-50 minute interview altogether, so we don't have time for all that now, but that will be up later this evening on our show page. So thanks to Martin Summers and also to our Lib Dem councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. You can join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world.
Holy water.
so that's from 2010. I'm not sure if the original's from 2010. That's my version of It's Mood Swings, Spiritual High with Chrissy Hynde. And welcome back to Not the BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So he's the father of Julian Assange, but don't be surprised if you haven't heard his name. John Shipton's been almost ignored by the London media in this globally important case about freedom of the press. Do we have it or not? In an exclusive interview with him tonight, he talks about Julian's misspent youth, his hopes for the case, and the incredible UC Global case, where a private spying company revealed a US obsession with hacking right into Julian's life, every aspect of it, in the Ecuadorian embassy. And also, in case you hadn't noticed, it's the 19th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks today. We hear from Arizona talk show host and former US Naval Intelligence Officer William Cooper. He was killed 8 weeks after the 9/11 attacks by undercover FBI agents. His show from the 28th of June 2001, that's 10 weeks before 9/11, all but predicts the 9/11 false flag attack on America and how that would be blamed on Osama bin Laden. He, by the way, Bill Cooper, was the prototype for doppelganger, that's what I call him, Alex Jones, who might sound familiar, and he actually sounds like a kind of similar kind of shock jock, US shock jock, broadcasting from neighbouring Texas. But Jones has none of the military insight, except that which he's fed from Rita Katz and the Mossad, and just uses his show now to bash Muslims in lockstep with the NATO intelligence services. So we hear from the genuine version tonight, the Hour of the Times' Bill Cooper, his show from the 28th of June 2001. Clip from that, quite a long clip, but I think you'll agree, pretty shocking that someone can predict 9/11 in that way. And they now say six people per bubble, so that's 6 feet apart, 6 months between lockdowns. 10:30 until 4 p.m. on Monday, they'll be outside Bristol Council House on College Green protesting against the no more than six social meeting rules. It's Stand Up X Bristol. And we hear from one of the people who spoke at the protest, Mark Devlin, a couple of weeks ago. Another protest movement, the 5G movement, has a new member. He's the super wealthy former president of Microsoft Canada. We'll be hearing from him. And finally, a medieval satanic group infiltrating all the monotheistic faiths, hell-bent on privatising the earth so they can buy it up, everything, for their own private property. That's the author of The Dying God we heard from the last couple of weeks. Another clip from him this week, giving his view on the origins of the fake Jewish Kabbalah. He's the author also of Transhumanism. We were hearing James Perloff talking about that. The History of a Dangerous Idea. That's David Livingston. We'll be hearing from him as well. But Martin, first of all, this is the main news of the week. So certainly as far as I'm concerned, is this incredible trial of Julian Assange and the hearings taking place in London with only Craig Murray and his immediate family even allowed in court. And the video feeds to a neighbouring court where other people were watching were switched off by the judge.
Yeah, I mean, what's going on there is in plain sight, but it's hardly being reported in the mainstream media, as you say. But it's an absolute outrage, frankly. I mean, this is the country of Magna Carta, as you will hear in great deal of rhetoric in the US in particular. And here we are, basically prosecuting somebody for telling the truth.
I mean, it's
there's no basis of English law for this at all. It's extraordinary.
It's one of those things that you hear chanted on the streets in protests. The whole world is watching, but this time it really is, isn't it?
Well, we're watching, but of course what they're doing is they're trying to make sure that hardly anybody knows what's going on.
Here in the UK, but other parts of the world are watching. Certainly many people in the US are very closely watching what's going on. Then, although the mainstream media is doing its best to stop them, obviously social media and other methods, this is being shared extensively.
Yeah, I mean, I think that those who are in the know are paying attention. But and it ought to be leading the news, in fact, in the mainstream. But it isn't, because there's definite attempts to control information. That's what the court is trying to do, is to prevent a normal situation where people could go to the court and report on it. So they can't keep people out completely, but they're doing their best.
Are you saying you don't think he's committed any crime?
I don't think he has committed any crime in English law. There's no basis for this at all. And don't forget, he's an Australian citizen who supposedly committed crimes in Britain, and he's being extradited to the United States and being put on trial for treason to the United States. He's not even a United States citizen. Well, and what the US is arguing is that anybody who speaks against the United States is a traitor to the United States, even if they're not a US citizen. And the other thing they're saying is that the freedom of speech, which is guaranteed in the US Constitution, is only guaranteed to US citizens. It's not to anybody. And so that it's a double jeopardy scenario for Assange, because he's not a US citizen. The freedom of speech of the US citizen doesn't apply to him, but also because even though he's not a US citizen, he's subject to US law, even though he's not in the country and he's never been a citizen of the country. Now, I would have thought that should have just been case dismissed straight away by the lowest level magistrate in any magistrate's court in England. But no, apparently not.
Well, one of the most incredible aspects of this case is the way that the US prosecutors have been shifting the sands. You know, the charges have been being changed, and only just last week, no new load of charges arrived.
That's because they'd argued that the previous charges were invalid, so they just come up with some new charges. And they're going to carry on doing that because they're basically making the point that the law is what they want it to be. But that's actually outrageous. I mean, the senior lawyers in this country should be up in arms about it. Some of them are. Clive Stafford Smith, who's a lawyer both in the US and Britain, was testifying this week. But, the people in charge of the case, Lady Arbuthnot and this woman Baratza, are, frankly, they're behaving as Nazi lawyers behaved in the 1930s. They're basically scofflaws.
I mean, the obvious headline in a tabloid paper would be Kangaroo Court, wouldn't it? Especially since we've got an Australian.
Exactly. I mean, that's the obvious point, isn't it? I mean, and don't forget, he's been effectively in solitary confinement for nearly a decade. Absolutely outrageous.
So what do you make of this due process being potentially, messed with here? Surely, if you've got a bunch of charges, the legal team have got to be able to deal with those charges, not to have them withdrawn and new charges brought in. This is, surely the judge herself should be saying, well, actually, no, you can't do that. If you want to drop those charges, that means the whole case is going to be dropped and Julian can walk free.
Well, that's because this is becoming a very, very important test case in English law, because they're basically overturning hundreds of years of precedent.
And a big test case in US law.
Well, in US law, you've got the Espionage Act, which was brought in the First World War, basically to silence critics of the First World War. So Eugene Debs, who was the leader of the Socialist Party in the US, was put in prison for 6 years under the Espionage Act. But even Eugene Debs was a US citizen, so you could argue that he could be charged under the Espionage Act because he'd been passed by Congress. Julian Assange is not a US citizen, but the US is arguing, as they've done in various other cases around the world, that their law applies to everybody, even though they don't get a vote in their election. So the courts in New York have agreed that Peter, I'm trying to remember his name now, but basically it doesn't really matter. They basically said that New York law overrides Argentinian law, and therefore that Argentina owes 100% of the debts that it supposedly owes, even though they've already made an agreement with their debtors to reduce the debts.
Well, there's a certain amount of arrogance to this, isn't there? It's not the US is assuming that it's a little bit like, that whole situation with the unified command structure, where the US military has got a command structure for every part of the planet. In other words, they dominate, they believe, every part of the planet militarily.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, if you're going to be polite, you'd call them the world's policemen. But they're not the world's policemen, they're the world's gangsters. And ultimately, of course, they're going to have to be put on trial. Not Assange, but the people in charge in the United States of America.
So let's have a listen now to John Shipton, who's Julian Assange's father. And I started off by asking him about the basic origins of Julian, what he was doing as a young man, what got him into doing WikiLeaks, and also about, and it's good to hear, of course, that WikiLeaks is still functioning quite happily without Julian. There are very various people. It's almost like there are plenty of Spartacuses still around to do the job. And the power of WikiLeaks, the actual ability of journalists and publishers, the pen being mightier than the sword, to make enormous great changes in military conflict. So let's have a listen to John Shipton now.
My name is John Shipton. I'm Julian Assange's father. Julian, well, has always been interested in mathematics, and that moved him into computers, as well as social protest. He was involved in the anti-global movement and the World Social Forum for a number of years before moving into WikiLeaks.
What do you think has been the most devastating revelations that Julian has published?
Well, they come in, you know, a lot of different directions. So, for example, one of the cables documents, that's the cables written by the United States soldiers in Iraq, one of them demonstrates that a group of soldiers murdered an entire family, the children, the mother, father, grandfather, uncle, father, they murdered a lot. Horrified at their crime, or horrified that they'd get charged with this crime, they called in the United States Air Force and destroyed the house completely, obliterating the evidence. This cable enraged the Iraqi government, who refused to sign the Status of Forces Agreement, which then required that all of the American troops be withdrawn from Iraq. That's what happened, leaving only those troops that were in the Green Zone, which is the vast embassy in American embassy in Baghdad.
Well, pretty amazing, Martin, there. So you can see the effect that publishing one document, a leaked document, this in this case a cable, can have. The Iraqi government removing the U.S. Army from the whole of Iraq, apart from just within the Green Zone, which, you know, is an enormous big change, because the Iraqis were informed. I suppose that's really what WikiLeaks is doing. It's informing the world, and particularly occupied countries, about what the U.S. is really up to behind the scenes.
Yeah, and you can see why they don't like it, because, you know, they don't go to war to lose, but of course they have lost and they deserve to lose.
Well, what do you make of what he was saying about Julian's early days as an anti-globalisation activist and also taking part in the World Social Forum?
Well, I mean, him and loads of other people. It just shows that he's basically got, you know, socially progressive views, as many people have. But he's taken it to a different level because of his journalistic work.
I can remember being part, I suppose, of these things myself, really. The anti-globalisation protests were big, weren't they, in the 1990s, enormous amount of them. Although they don't seem to be such, it doesn't seem to be such a movement today. Things like Extinction Rebellion are possibly even the opposite. They're saying that we need a global response rather than anti-breaking down national boundaries. They're saying the opposite.
Well, I think it's a different generation, obviously, but a lot of the demands are similar. And of course, this big success of the anti-globalisation movement was to prevent the signing of the Doha. I think it was the Doha round of the World Trade Organization. So they couldn't. I mean, it wasn't just that. What really messed up the plan was that the farmers in India refused to sign up for what Monsanto and others were trying to do, and therefore the whole thing, you know, after decades of discussion, had to be shelved. And as we are learning to our cost, doing trade deals is actually a lot more complicated than it's presented in the mainstream media.
So I also asked John Shipton, who's Julian Assange's father, I asked him about what he made of the media coverage of the case.
I will praise them for their stance lately. They've come aboard. The Washington Post editorial, the New York Times editorial, even the Guardian's editorial, the Times last Sunday, the Times on Sunday, the Mail on Sunday. So they've all come around to realize that if Julian's extradited on and thrown in a dungeon for 175 years, their power, their ability to publish, and their prestige, and consequently their living standards, go down the drain. So they've come around to realize it's their own self-interest, and they're changing their mind and supporting us.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? So his father is, although, of course, there's been some very negative coverage of Julian over the years, or positive coverage. It's been so strange to see the mass media's reaction. But it looks as if, as it's coming down to the wire, the mass media, at least in this country, Martin, he's talking about actually in the US too, is saying, well, actually, this is potentially going to affect every journalist on the planet.
Well, I hope that's the case. And, I can't remember whether there's not even a jury involved in this trial, is there? But I mean, historically, there have been very important trials in Britain where the state has tried to convict people and failed. And they've been the basis of most of our modern civil liberties are a result of these basically illegal trials which have been overturned. So let's hope that this can be another one.
11 years of incarceration is a long time, you know, for justice, the wheels of justice turning very, very slowly.
Well, if you think back to it, he went into the Ecuadorian embassy, and because of the psychological warfare against him, there was enormous amounts of fuss. I mean, we had councillors on here from Liberal Democrats saying, oh, well, he's got to go and stand trial in Sweden. He was never charged with anything in Sweden. And what he said all along was, what this is about is to try and get me extradited to the United States. And loads of people were saying, oh, he's just making this up. He doesn't want to stand trial in Sweden for doing naughty things. And this is all just made up. But of course, as soon as the police went into the embassy and arrested him with the agreement of Lenin Moreno back in Ecuador, because he was in the pocket of the Americans, and then they immediately put him on trial to go to be extradited
to
the US.
So in other words,
he was right all along.
But it was all affected by a big switch in politics over in Ecuador.
Yeah. I mean, what happened was Rafael Correa, who was the president, twice re-elected president, under the rules in Ecuador, he couldn't stand for a third term. So Lenin Moreno was one of his followers, and it was decided that he would stand instead of Correa. But Moreno, despite his name Lenin, because he came from a left-wing family, he's basically turned out to be a running dog of imperialism, as they sometimes call them in China. And he's basically they got an IMF loan, and on the back to carry out privatizations and so on in Ecuador, because Correa had been very successful in the same kind of way.
Well, that's a massive
as in Bolivia with Evo Morales. You know, they had a shared agenda.
Aren't these massive international mafia bribes, really?
Well, it's not a bribe so much, because the money that they've got from the IMF in Ecuador is only if they carry out various privatizations and allow...
Yeah, but it looks great, doesn't it? Oh, suddenly companies. We've got loads of money. Even if you're not the person, you're not the president, that has to pay the money back.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, he's basically a traitor to the cause. I mean, he was elected on the same kind of platform as Correa. But he's basically turncoat.
So what the Americans are trying to do here is, number one, is extend their legal jurisdiction into Britain. And number two is to create this, with his 175-year sentence, an enormous chilling effect to make sure that nobody ever thinks like behaving like Julian Assange, that is publishing leaked US secrets, even if it does involve massive violations of human rights and international law and murder, even mass murder. That doesn't seem to matter.
Well, we're on the anniversary of 9/11, and they're quite capable of mass murder, as we all know.
One of the most shocking aspects to the case is the parallel case which has been going on over in Spain about this interesting little company. Can't remember their name, but anyway, do you know them, Martin?
I know who you're talking about. It's basically a private Spanish company, and they were contracted by the CIA to spy on Assange. And what's happened is that the legal...
Oh, it's UC Global.
Yeah, the legal establishment in Spain, because in Spain, as they've got a different system. So Balthazar Garzón, for example, was an independent prosecutor. And, of course, he famously sent Íñigo to prison, who was a socialist interior minister, as a terrorist, because he was involved in organising death squads in the Basque region. So you've got an independent judiciary in Spain.
We've had the Spanish king, the former Spanish king, actually had to go into exile, because otherwise he was going to be prosecuted.
Yeah, well, you've got to remember the history in Spain. None of the Francoists were ever prosecuted for anything they'd done in the years they were in power. But of course, the Balthazar Garçon started to push for some kind of restitution in relation to those things. And you've got an activist judiciary, and what they've been able to do is it was a Spanish company that was involved in this, based in Spain, and they arrested them, and they're being charged with attempt to pervert the course of justice.
Well, one it does see this to a certain extent as almost a competition between the effectiveness of the British and the Spanish judicial system.
Well, that's happened over Pinochet, if you remember, because the Spaniards wanted to extradite him to Spain to stand trial, and Margaret Thatcher famously protected him under her skirts and gave him a memento of the Spanish Armada, because he managed to escape back to Chile and didn't have to stand trial.
Yes, and Andre Vilcek, who's a fairly regular appearer on this show, he was actually over in Chile helping to denazify the country after Pinochet left.
Well, I mean, I don't know what his particular role was. I mean, it's still got a problem in Chile because the army is still effectively...
Well, they had these Nazi encampments. I mean, we're not talking about neo-Nazi. We're talking about they were actually run by people who were directly descended from the SS, people like this, and they were running torture camps and things.
Well, I mean,
usually up at, in farms in the Andes, and they had to get rid of them all after Pinochet.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact is that many people from that era were never prosecuted when they should have been. And, of course, the army is still there in Chile, and you've got a civilian government. But as you know, last year there was massive protests in Chile about the economic situation before COVID or anything else kicked in, and quite a lot of protesters were killed by the police. In fact, a lot more protesters were killed by the police in Chile than have been killed in Belarus. I don't think any have been killed in Belarus, but loads were killed in Chile. There you go.
So let's have a listen to our final clip from John Shipton, Julian Assange's father. And like with James Perloff, I will put up this full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But here he is talking about this incredible hacking right into Julian's life by this UC Global company, which is under trial at the moment in Spain.
The case is ongoing in Spain. They have a different system, as you know, where the judge investigates rather than hears the two sides from the QCs. The judge in Spain investigates. So there's an investigation going on there, very vigorous. The UC Global converted all the cameras and installed new cameras in the embassy, even installing a microphone in the ladies' toilet. I mean, really and truly. Recorded Julian's conferences with lawyers. This is illegal, you know. I mean, it's illegal to spy anyway, but it's an abuse of process. It means that the case cannot go ahead because the relationship between the lawyer and the client is protected. Also, they speculated on how to murder Julian by poison, how to kidnap him. Then they made moves to double lock the door so he couldn't walk out. So they became jailers as well as attempting to murder, spying. They followed Julian's lawyers down the street in Brussels. They burgled Julian's lawyer, Balthazar Garçon's offices in Madrid and so on. So also the head of that time of UC Global, the security firm that we're speaking of that was in charge of security at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, he took hard disks once a month over to the United States, handing them over to, well, we presume, the CIA, because at that time, the head of the CIA was Mike Pompeo, who in April 2017 declared that the WikiLeaks was going to be ruined and Julian was going to be persecuted to the ends of the earth.
So where does the case go from here? Because it seems to be sort of almost every 6 or 8 months that the case has been popping up. Where does it go from this hearing?
All depends. One of the QCs for the prosecution, his spouse, her spouse, sorry, came down with a temperature on today, you know, reported in the morning that he had a temperature. So they suspect COVID. So they're doing a test, and they'll have their results on Monday morning. If it is COVID, I don't know what the court will do. I can't speculate. If it isn't, it'll go on for the next 4 weeks.
And after that, would Julian? Do you think Julian may be sent to the US?
I imagine what will happen. I don't think it. I imagine what will happen in normal practice is if the judge says he's free to go, the United States will vigorously appeal and will go to the High Court. If the judge says that he's to be extradited, we will vigorously appeal and will go to the High Court. So that, and that will probably take until May, June.
So it could be that Julian walks out of this court into the street a free man?
Well, you know, I'm not a religious man, but I've taken up to going to the Brompton Oratory and lighting candles. Brompton Oratory being the local Catholic church.
John Chipton, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. It's been a pleasure.
So that's John Chipton. You can hear the complete interview. I'll pop it up later tonight on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But that whole UC Global case, Martin, is absolutely incredible. That is going on in Spain right now. It's obvious that these people were, at least this is it is alleged, that they were burgling the lawyers. They were planning to poison Julian Assange, potentially kill Julian Assange. And that they were working absolutely in lockstep with people like Mike Pompeo, who at the same time as they're accused of taking hard disks over to the CIA, Pompeo is trumpeting that he's going to bring down WikiLeaks and Julian Assange forever.
Yeah, well, what's ironic about this is who are the criminals? Who are the criminals here? Is it Julian Assange or is it Mike Pompeo and his acolytes? And of course, if Julian Assange goes free, maybe there should be prosecutions of those involved.
Well, maybe
in
this
whole,
is maybe this is why.
Why should we just sit back and take this?
Maybe this is why the establishment is doing everything it can to make sure he doesn't go free, because of the implications of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, what happens in the US is you do get plea bargaining, so you might get a situation where we let you go as long as you don't pursue this any further. But of course, Balthazar Garzon was forced out of the mainstream judiciary in Spain. He was a senior guy because he started to ask for investigations into what happened during the Franco era. And of course, there's still a lot of Francoists in senior positions in Spain. And obviously, they're very close to the CIA. I mean, Balthazar Garzon is quite similar to Fernando Imposimato in Italy, because of course he was the one who exposed Gladio, and Garzon is a similar character. And I think both Garzon and Imposimato show a way forward out of the mess, which is we don't have to go to war, we've just got to put all these people behind bars, and I don't mean Julian Assange.
So also, just to let you know what John Shipton was telling us there about a possible COVID-19 case amongst the prosecution lawyer's family, apparently it's a false alarm, although I thought that the results of the case...
Oh, that's a relief.
We're going to come on Monday, but somehow...
I'm so happy about that.
There's some other reason for this high temperature. Maybe they've been sitting next to a radiator or something instead of having some kind of disease of COVID-19. But more importantly, Martin, the prosecution are saying in the court today that the prosecution is really part of Donald Trump's war on journalism.
Yeah, well, Trump at one stage was saying that WikiLeaks, because WikiLeaks exposed the Steele dossier and everything to do with that, and also WikiLeaks it was that showed that the DNC National Committee were rigging the election, the primaries in the last election, in president election in the US, against Bernie Sanders. And then and they showed that, showed that they were doing that. And B, both Craig Murray, of course, who flew to the US to pick up the material, that it was nothing to do with the Russians at all. And you know, at one stage, Trump was quite pleased that WikiLeaks had exposed that. But then, of course, he started going on about WikiLeaks, I've never heard of it. Even though, of course, we had loads and loads of things, him saying WikiLeaks have exposed the truth here, WikiLeaks, 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 WikiLeaks. But, of course, he's now decided to throw Assange to the wolves because, do you know what? I think Donald's not really a very nice guy. And I don't think I trust him.
The irony of all of this, of course, is that these procedures being taken by UC Global and the CIA, you know, basically stealing lawyers' materials, you know, planning to poison Julian Assange, stealing, hacking into it, is actually what's going on is Assange is being prosecuted for what the CIA and these private security people are doing themselves.
Yeah, well, ultimately, as I said earlier, this shows a way forward. Not only are we going to bust Assange out of that prison, hopefully, which will be a very big victory for civil rights in this country, but we're also going to put the people involved on trial. And, you know, Interpol need to be involved. People like Mike Pompeo, who openly boasted that we lie, we cheat, we steal, he's going to regret that.
And he's hopefully. Also saying, of course, he's not going to tolerate China. Yeah. What exactly does that mean?
What it means is they're trying to break the Chinese system now before they become predominant in the second half of the 21st century, which is basically they're plotting a war, as they've been plotting wars. We've had quite a few of them. This is the biggest one.
Well, the trial is going to resume on Monday. There's a great crowd gathers daily outside the Old Bailey in support of Julian, and that's obviously going to be carrying on. Well, I mean, there'll be a longer and bigger trials. I think the longer trial is going to be taking place, the actual extradition hearing itself, next year. But as part of all of this, there's been quite a lot of other support for Julian Assange. One is a series of lectures and talks and discussions called Imperialism on Trial. Another one of these happened this week with various journalists, some of them wearing face masks and the audience all social distance and that sort of thing. But they are, and one of the things that came up at this was one of the journalists there is Neil Clark, who we've interviewed him, I think it was on the Politics Show or Dialect not so long ago. And Neil is quite famous for doing he's famous, he is in my book anyway, for doing what I consider to be the greatest article on Jeremy Corbyn's, why Jeremy Corbyn lost the December 29 election, which is entitled The Shakespearean Tragedy of Jeremy Corbyn, really looking at the way he treated his enemies better than his friends in his own party. But so here, anyway, Neil Clark at this Imperialism on Trial discussion last week in London brought up the matter of Belarus. Now, Martin, before we hear from Neil, you've been doing these reports on RT about Belarus. Can you just give us in a nutshell whether or not you think that Belarus is going to is this going to carry on? It's become a bit like Venezuela. The mass media constantly, particularly the BBC and the BBC World Service, have been saying, oh, you know, this Lukashenko, even though he was elected president, although they sometimes don't even say that, has got to go. They just repeat this, a little bit like what we had with Assad has got to go, Gaddafi has got to go. Now it's Lukashenko.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to predict the future, but Lukashenko's position is that I won the election fair and square, and you can't just get rid of me because I won. And I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that he lost. He's certainly a bit of a control freak, and the opposition have got legitimate gripes about the way they've been treated. I'm willing to listen to that. But they can't claim that they won the election because they didn't. They got 10% of the vote. They might have got 15% or 20%, but that's not winning the election. It's, you know, Lukashenko's been in power for 26 years because he's quite popular.
Isn't it also the case that Belarus is really the last Eastern European country which was part of the old Soviet Union, the Russian bloc or the Soviet bloc, the Warsaw Pact, that has not started to lean towards the West, towards the EU and towards NATO? You know, we had 5 years ago, we had Ukraine, which switched its allegiance after a coup. But Belarus is one of the last. And also, very importantly, there's this little enclave of Kaliningrad in Poland, which is on
it's not in Poland. Where it's separate from Poland.
Well, it's but it's kind
of... It's contiguous to Poland, but it's not Poland. It's part of Russia.
Yeah, so, but Belarus, in order for Kaliningrad to be able to continue, Belarus has surely got to be, continue to be a Russian-leaning, otherwise Kaliningrad would be completely isolated.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are clearly military implications if Belarus was to switch sides. There's no doubt about that. But Kaliningrad is part of Russia, and therefore it's not an independent state. It's literally part of Russia.
It borders onto the Baltic, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. Both sides. I mean, if there was,
how did Kaliningrad get there?
It was given to the Russians at the end of World War II. Because there was basically a German population there, and just as in Poland and in Czechoslovakia, that German population was deported back to Germany. Even though they'd lived there for hundreds of years, they were deported back to Germany. You could claim that that's unfair, but that was what was agreed, and the West agreed it, and that's what happened. And of course, then a Russian population was brought in, and it's now virtually 100% Russian. And that's the reality of the situation.
Belarus kind of stretches out from the west of Russia. It's a kind of little bubble, a pocket that reaches almost towards Kaliningrad, but doesn't quite make it there.
Yeah, so in other words, from a military point of view, it's important for both sides, because what they call the Suvalki Gap is that gap. And of course, it links Belarus, it links Poland and Lithuania, yeah? So, and of course, there's actually disputes between Poland and Lithuania going back to before the war, but the current border is there. So, you know, NATO wants that border to remain their border, as it were. And of course, but Belarus is important in a sense for backing Kaliningrad, but in another sense, it's not, because that gap, the Suvalki Gap, is already controlled by NATO. So I suppose from a military point of view, you could see an armoured column could drive from Belarus to Kaliningrad to link it back up. So I don't think anything like that is going to happen. So it's silly to talk in those terms. And most of what's going on is political struggles about the direction of things.
Why is it,
rather
though,
than military?
Do you think that Belarus has been the last country left which is still pro-Soviet and still largely got a kind of rural Soviet economy?
Well, I mean, you've almost answered your own question there. What happened in 91 when the Soviet Union broke up, that Belarus just found itself independent? And Lukashenko didn't come to power immediately, but he did quite soon afterwards. And he used to be a collective farm manager. So that used to be his job. He used to manage a collective farm. So he was basically a middle manager, if you like. And what he said to people is, all the stuff that's going on around us in Russia and in the Baltic states and Poland, we're not going to do any of that. We're going to carry on with our collective farms. We're going to carry on having state-owned industry which services those farms. The big enterprises in Belarus are basically agricultural machinery enterprises and fertilizer enterprises.
Okay, yeah? So it's not worth so much because it's not highly industrialized. Well, it's mainly agricultural.
Well, yeah, and the industry such as it is related to agriculture. Although the other thing they do actually is they've got quite a bit of military industry. And fascinatingly enough, they actually fix kit both for the Russians and the Ukrainians. And the Ukrainians are actually rather dependent. You know, they buy a lot of Belarusian stuff. Anyway, the point is why he's been popular is because he hasn't done what the other countries have done, which is put everybody on out of work, and so on.
Martin, that sentiment is echoed by Neil Clark, who visited and wrote some articles for the New Statesman, or at least an article for the New Statesman on Belarus back in 2010. So let's hear from Neil Clark now, the journalist, speaking earlier this week at the Imperialism on Trial Free Julian Assange meeting in London.
It was so interesting on the Sunday before last, I don't know if anybody looked at the BBC News website, big headlines, Belarus protest. Sweet Belarus, Minsk, wall-to-wall coverage on the BBC and the BBC website. And there was nothing on the BBC of the 35 or 40,000 people who had demonstrated in London against the lockdowns. So I think it's quite strange that the BBC website decided that Belarus was the biggest story for British, the the British public to listen to or to watch, whereas a big demo in London, literally down the road from the BBC, was not news. The Belarus situation has had enormous coverage in the media, in a lot of so-called liberal papers, and it's quite extraordinary when you consider that Belarus is not on most British people's radar. A lot of people probably wouldn't know where it was. I don't mean that derogatory. It's a fact. A lot of people might be confused where it was. And yet, for the people deciding these stories at the BBC and other places, it is the number one story. You know, 50,000 people in London or 40,000? No, we're not interested in that. Belarus, people are on the streets in Minsk. And Lukashenko has been in power in Belarus since late 1994. I went to Belarus in 2010, and I wrote about Belarus for the New Statesman. I thought it was a very balanced report, and the flack I got for that piece was one of the worst attacks I've had from establishment enforcers. I had actually been to Belarus, and yet I was being attacked for writing what I thought was a fair appraisal of the country and acknowledging that Lukashenko did have, certainly at that time, genuine support from the public because of the economic policies he pursued. There was full employment, there were still factories, and there was still a very good social system. It was a very egalitarian society, and they had avoided a lot of the shock therapy that a lot of the former Soviet bloc countries had. But you couldn't say that. It was a no-no. You can't say anything positive about Belarus. And then it all kind of went quiet a bit, and now it's kind of the main story again. So some saying it's about Russia, and also it's interesting Belarus, one of the two countries in Europe that did not have a lockdown this year over the coronavirus. And Lukashenko claimed that the IMF had said they would give him 10 times as much money if he locked down the country like Italy. So that's another argument why there's such emphasis on Belarus now. What's going to be the end game? Would Russia allow a government to come to power there that would threaten it by becoming a NATO member, having NATO troops in Belarus?
I don't think there's any danger that, I mean, don't forget that Lukashenko had fallen out with Putin, because what he was doing was he was trying to steer a middle course. So although it was one of the things that allowed him to have the successful economic policy that he had was getting lots of cheap oil and gas from Russia. But at the same time, he was flirting with the West and saying, what would you give me if I was to come over to your side?
Well, yes,
which, of course, annoyed the Russians.
This middle course didn't work very well for Jeremy Corbyn, did it?
Well, I mean, they were mixing two things up here.
Well, no, I'm saying that if you've got to actually make a decision as a leader. You can't say, oh, well, actually, I'm going to try and play two powers off against each other.
Well, no, I mean, you've got two different situations with different power dynamics going on. I mean, they're similar in the sense that they're both political situations, but you can't claim that there's a great deal in common between them.
What do you make about this idea of effectively a bribe by the IMF to have a lockdown?
Lukashenko's saying, yes. I mean, that's certainly true. But of course, the problem for Lukashenko is when these protests erupted after the election, the Russians had gone rather cool on him because he'd basically been encouraging the West for some time. Which is a bad mistake on his part. He should have recognised which side his bread was buttered on. And therefore, they were not that unhappy to see him given a bit of a shock. But I don't think, precisely because he's got quite a substantial body of support inside Belarusia, I'm quite sure that the Russians are fairly confident that he can hang on. And what they want to see is a more open situation in Belarusia, but without it necessarily going to NATO. And of course, what they are trying to do indirectly is talk with the opposition, saying, well, if you were given a better chance to win elections in Belarusia, what sort of things would you do? And therefore, we're not necessarily hostile to you. But you've got to, I mean, fundamentally, what they've got to recognise, including the Western press and the Western media and Western governments, is they didn't win the election.
Okay, so are we going to see something similar to Venezuela with a bunch of American mercenaries being sent into Belarus to try and kill Lukashenko or create a coup?
Well, I mean, in Ukraine, they definitely did. I mean, they basically assassinated over 80 people.
But is it going to happen? Do you think they're
going to dare to do it?
I don't think
so, because in Belarusia, you've got a much more homogenous society. in Ukraine is basically a bit of a, you know, is only created in 91. It's an incredibly varied society with very, very big social divisions.
If you were,
Belarus is smaller.
If you were Lukashenko, would you be tempted by Brussels and to sort
well,
of
no, obviously, obviously now he's not. I mean, what happened for him is a bit like Gaddafi. He started to say, all right, I want to be a good boy now. What are you going to do to help me? And he was encouraged to think that he was going to be helped. And then they just turn around and whack him in the face when they get close enough. And I think he's learned his lesson, frankly.
Just briefly back to Prime Minister's questions for a couple of, one on the Brexit negotiations and another one on China, Martin, that, apparently we've broken international law now, by ripping up the, agreement with the European Union. This is a bit of a naughty thing to do. Let's hear. Obviously, the SNP have been particularly angry about that, so they were having a go at Boris Johnson about it at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Ian Blackford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Shortly, this government will publish its internal market proposals. I've seen them. It is nothing short of an attack on Scotland's Parliament and an affront to the people of Scotland. As we've already heard, this legislation breaks international law, but it also breaks domestic law. The Prime Minister and his friends, a parcel of rogues, are creating a rogue state, one where the rule of law does not apply. Why does the Prime Minister think that he and his friends are above the law?
Hear, hear.
Well, on the contrary, Mr. Speaker, this UK internal market bill is about protecting jobs, protecting growth, ensuring the fluidity and safety of our UK internal market and prosperity throughout the United Kingdom. And it should be welcomed, I believe, in Scotland, in Northern Ireland, Wales, and throughout the whole country.
He's talking there about the internal market, but it seems as if legally this whole Brexit business seems to be coming apart, both internally in the UK with the other countries, particularly Northern Ireland and Scotland, getting very upset about what the English are doing, but also internationally with Brussels too.
It's very interesting that they've chosen to do this. I suspected he might try and do this once he got his... I mean, we're talking about Boris Johnson and his brain, Dominic Cummings. I think a lot of this is a political decision by Cummings that because they've lost a lot of ground during the COVID crisis for whatever reason, that they can rally the troops by saying, because of course what the deal was that you can have any deal you like for Britain as a whole. You know, you can even have a no deal, but you can't enforce that in Northern Ireland where the majority clearly voted to remain inside the EU and therefore implicitly inside the single market. And Johnson agreed that in order to get an agreement with the EU, including the Irish. And then he ran an election campaign saying we're going to have a deal based on this. The DUP didn't support him, of course. Now, we can probably get this through Parliament because although there may be some Tory rebels against this, the DUP will probably vote for it because they don't want a border in the Irish Sea. But the agreement that Johnson made with the Irish and the EU was that there would be a border in the Irish Sea.
Well, the Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin has said there are now justifiable doubts as to whether the UK actually wants to conclude negotiations at all.
Well, I think that's pretty obvious from the get-go. What they want is a no-deal Brexit or near as damn it. And, of course, that would, in a sense, that would have been acceptable to the EU as long as Northern Ireland isn't included in it. But, of course, he's gone the extra mile now to get his own right wing going, and the loyalists, of course, as that we're not going to have it. We're going to have a hard border in Ireland, which, of course, this is what it's all about.
Martin, the Jacob Rees-Moggs of this world will be saying, well, actually, this is really what the Brussels negotiators want. They don't actually really want an agreement either. And so we are going to have to be the ones that... I suppose tear up the withdrawal agreement because that we can't come to an agreement with them.
Well, the withdrawal agreement, the aspects of the withdrawal agreement that are causing all the bother are related to Ireland. And of course, that was the sticking point. What Theresa May had negotiated with the EU is that there wouldn't be a border in the Irish Sea or a border in Northern Ireland because there would basically be the same rules on both sides of the Irish Sea. Effectively, a soft Brexit. Now, that's not satisfactory to the right wing of the Tory party. They want a hard Brexit. And the EU position, the Irish position, is okay, you can have that, but you can't have it in Ireland because we don't want it. And it's all a question of sovereignty for Ireland, never mind sovereignty for the UK. But what Cummings and Johnson are doing is going for broke here. They're trying to create as much conflict as possible so that they can then pretend that when we get to a no deal, as we're going to do at the end of December, it's somehow the Irish fault. But of course, the Irish don't see it that way.
Well, we talked earlier, didn't we, about COVID ramping up the tensions with China. Chinese warplanes this week have entered Taiwan. In fact, today, Chinese warplanes have entered Taiwan airspace for a second day. Now, this is a running sore, isn't it? And one does look back at the British Empire and things like Kashmir. It's almost as if these big empires over the years have left these situations like the Taiwan situation, which is independent of China, even though China claims it as part of itself, as running sores. And there's more and more attention on Taiwan now because the US is ramping up its trade war with China. But what do you make of these Chinese warplanes now flying over Taiwan?
Well, I mean, all of these conflicts are a product of history, whether in Ireland, Taiwan, Kashmir, Palestine. And of course, many of them are a result of the British Empire.
The Taiwanese, by the way, have been doing missile tests off the island's coast. So yeah. That seems to be the reason why China is saying, well, if you're going to be testing missiles off the coast, we're going to be flying our aeroplanes around having a good old look at you.
Don't forget, I think the Royal Navy and the US are happily steaming into what the Chinese regard as their own territorial waters. And the Chinese have got quite a big navy. They could be carrying out exercises off the coast of in the channel, as long as they do it, what would happen if they did? I mean, of course, the other thing that happened, you mentioned last week about the B-52s at Fairford, they flew over the whole of Europe and then flew right along the front line in Ukraine, round Crimea, and then flew all the way back again. Basically, coat trailing is what they used to call that in Ireland, bit of coat trailing. And of course, they're daring the Russians to shoot at them. Isn't that wonderful?
So you heard it here first, folks. That's what those aircraft were. I mean, it was.
Well, you didn't hear it. I got it from somewhere else.
Well,
I mean,
yes, but
I didn't get any inside information.
We were flagging this up a couple of weeks ago. Look at these B-52s landing at Fairford. Could they be? Actually, we were talking, I think, about Belarus, weren't we?
Yep.
And that clearly seems to be the direction that they were heading in over that direction to sort of annoy the Russians.
Yeah, but there's been various run-ins between aircraft in the Baltic and in Black Sea.
But the point is, this makes Gloucestershire a nuclear target. Why do we want these B-52s based here in Gloucestershire? We don't.
Well, you and I don't, but the government's position is we want our sovereignty, which means that when the Americans decide to go to war with Iran or assassinate Iran's top general, we're ready to go woof, we're his master's voice. That's sovereignty Tory style.
Okay, so anyway, back to China and Prime Minister's questions. China came up this week.
One minute.
Mr. Speaker, they herd them onto trains, they shave their heads, they abort their babies. A genocide of the Uyghur people by the Chinese government is taking place before our eyes. It is easy to criticise the next world superpower, harder to take action. What action is the Prime Minister going to take to stop the ethnic cleansing of the Uyghur people in Xinjiang? And when will he lead organisation of an international tribunal? Because this time, no country can say that they didn't know.
Well, Mr. Speaker, she is entirely right to draw attention to the plight of the Uyghurs, as both I and the Foreign Secretary have done ourselves, and we raise these concerns directly with the Chinese authorities, and I will continue to do so in the G20, the UN, and in every other context.
When is there going to be an international tribunal to put the British politicians on trial who have caused the biggest humanitarian catastrophe on the planet today in Yemen? British military personnel are currently in Saudi Arabia helping murder children, the ethnic cleansing of the Houthis, and it's probably far more people are being killed in Yemen than are being killed in...
Does that make the persecution of the Uyghurs in China okay?
No, it doesn't. And in actual fact, if Britain wanted to do something about the Uyghurs in China, they should show that they could care about human rights in Yemen, and then they'd have a case to make. In actual fact, they've got no case to make because they are involved in ethnic cleansing all over the world, not just the Chinese. But it's funny that the Chinese are the ones we want to talk about, where we can't do anything about it. Where we can do something about it, we don't want to talk about it at all.
It does sound to me like you're kind of just making excuses for Chinese, Martin.
Let's discuss what the problems are. The Uyghurs have got thousands...
The Uyghurs, yeah.
Uyghurs have got thousands of their young men fighting in Syria. They're not from Syria, but they're part of...
So they basically have a security problem, and that's why they're doing this.
Yes.
So Syria, next door to that, is what? Israel? Israeli airstrikes, apparently, over the last day or so, have been targeting Aleppo. So the Israelis are shooting... they're overflying Syria. They are bombing Aleppo, but they're not admitting it. So this is news coming out of Syria and the Middle East generally, but the Israelis don't want to admit that they're actually overflying Syria and carrying on bombing.
Well, I'd be interested to know what their targets are in Aleppo. I think Aleppo is now under the control of the Syrian government, isn't it? So they're attacking Syrian government army targets.
Just read out this from antiwar.com. Israeli attacks on targets across Syria. More on Thursday. Details of the damage inflicting are unclear, with Syrian state media claiming the military have intercepted a lot of missiles and initially there was no damage or casualties. What was being attacked is not clear, though state media said the T4 airbase was where one burst of missiles was headed. They were said to have been fired from Syrian airspace near Al Tanf, a US-controlled base. They're after the airports, basically, the airfields.
Yeah. So, I mean, what tends to happen in the run-up to World War One, everybody was accusing everybody else of oppressing people. And as we know in warfare, the first casualty is truth. Everybody is pushing their own agenda about what they think should be happening and telling how terrible the other side are. And, of course, ignoring their own egregious misbehaviour, which we don't want to talk about.
Well, we're going to have a little look at, as it's the 11th of September today, the 19th anniversary of the September the 11th attacks. Martin, you got involved quite early, as I did, with the 9/11 Truth Movement here in the UK. And one of the chairs of that was a chap called Justin Walker. Another one was Ian R. Crane, who has literally very recently just recovered from a serious life-threatening disease of some sort. But anyway, I thought we'd have a chat to Justin Walker this week and see what he made of 9/11, COVID and climate change. He's also very much focused on the economic problems. So it's before we hear from Justin, I mean, in what way are these connected, do you think? We've already talked about the massive bailouts caused by the lockdowns under cover of the lockdowns. But does this link up, do you think, to the Great Reset? And does it link up to 9/11 too or not?
Well, I think everything's connected to everything else. But on the other hand, the way in which it's connected, I think there's legitimate disagreement about how all these things fit together. So before I make any comment, let's hear what Justin's got to say.
We know that we've had the fake science, the bad science of man-made global warming pumped into the schoolrooms and everywhere you look. Big business now and the banking, Bank for International Settlements, the Bank of England, all these big financial institutions are all talking about climate change and getting CO2 and, you know, any companies now that don't go along with man-made global warming will find themselves penalized and put out of business. I mean, you know, everywhere you look now, it is the big Green Deal, the new Green Deal. So what we now have is the new Green Deal coupled with this thing called the Great Reset, which a guy called Schwartz, what's his first name? I can't think of his first name. But anyway, the guy who created the World Economic Forum at Davos, he came up with a thing called the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And that is taking humanity towards transhumanism and centralized living cells, which run by 5G. I mean, the whole thing is a nightmare. It is effectively fascism. It is basically the world being run by technology, and you will do as you're told. You'll be microchipped. You'll be basically attached in weird ways to the internet of all things. And anyway, it's just a nightmare scenario that's building. But they are going for this great reset. And to do that, they had to trash the global economy. They had to cause such a jolt in the economy that they could justify triggering this great reset. So this sudden pandemic has come along, which is now being used to reset the economy. And, well, as far as I'm concerned, it is 9/11. It's another form of 9/11 because everyone's, well, not everyone, far from it, but a large number of people still believe the official accounts of what the governments are saying, that we're being blitzed by this dreadful pandemic. The winter of 2017-2018 in this country. And you can go to the Office of National Statistics to get the facts. During the winter of 2017-2018, excess deaths, this country experienced 50,100. 50,100 excess deaths. Now, I believe the current death toll for the whole of coronavirus in this country is roughly around about 43,000. They had to revise it downwards, but it is well below the 50,000 we lost during the winter of 2017-2018.
So that's Justin Walker there speaking to me earlier this week, Martin. Again, with Justin, I'll put the longer version of that interview up with him on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But he's definitely pointing to this great reset. Everyone has got to keep their eyes fixed on it because he believes that that there is a whole new kind of deeper, worse level of international financial architecture coming along, and that the COVID has been used as an excuse to bring this in. That's effectively what he's saying.
Well, I tend to agree. I mean, it's quite clear that we've reached an inflection point in world affairs. I mean, the situation we're in now is by far the most serious since World War II. But I don't necessarily agree with every aspect of the of his analysis. People disagree about things. We don't always necessarily see eye to eye.
Also, I thought it'd be useful. I mean, we've had we had a poem last week, and we've got this Stand Up Bristol protest going on between 10:30 and 4 p.m. On Monday outside the council house on College Green against the new rules about no more than six people being able to socialise together, basically saying that there's no real justification for it at all. And there are, by the way, court cases chugging along which are challenging these, judicial reviews, that sort of thing. I thought we'd have a listen to Mark Devlin, who was one of the speakers at the Stand Up Bristol protest on the 30th of August, which I was also speaking at, and we heard the poem from last week. Mark Devlin hails from Oxford. He's got basically, I suppose, an ICist, you would call him, but he's got also, he had quite a lot to say about 9/11 too. I find it fascinating that there are people looking at this as the sort of domestic version of 9/11, whereas 9/11 was affecting foreign policy and the Foreign Office. This is almost like the Home Office version being carried out on us now. So here's Mark Devlin. Here he is, and his power cut out to his microphone, and so he picked up a megaphone and carried on his speech.
Can you still hear me?
Yes!
Okay. So we're the ones that are getting painted as the dangerous ones that are affecting everyone's safety because we're not observing these measures. But look at how everything's been twisted and inverted. We are the ones who are standing up for the rights and freedoms, not just for ourselves, but for everybody else.
Yes.
And yet we're being framed as dangerous people who are helping to spread the virus. Meanwhile, the vast majority of the population are walking around in their masks,
yes,
being fearful the way they've been instructed to be, thinking this makes them good people, thinking they're doing the right thing. There's no virtue in being a slave.
Yay!
There's no virtue in kowtowing to tyrannical governmental regimes. And that's how everything gets inverted, because people don't realise these are the mind games that are played on them by the treacherous mainstream media? And why do people even still believe a word that comes out of the mouth of these mainstream media or lamestream media operations when they've got a proven track record of lying to us time and time again? How short people's memories are. Wasn't it the very mainstream media that's telling us to be afraid of this virus that told us about weapons of mass destruction coming out of Iraq, which turned out to be a lie?
Didn't they tell us that?
Yes.
Wasn't it the same mainstream media that told us Osama bin Laden had been taken out by a crack team of Navy SEALs on the 1st of May, interesting date, 2011, 10 years after he actually died at the end of 2001, as reported by a whole load of Middle Eastern newspapers at the time. The same mainstream media that told us Iraqi soldiers in the first Gulf War had been going into hospitals and taking babies out of incubators and leaving them on the floor to die, which later turned out to be a complete concoction, a complete lie, and the woman who told the story was the daughter of an American ambassador to one of these countries. The same mainstream media, the same BBC, where they heard their reporter Jane Stanley standing in front of World Trade Center 7 telling us it had collapsed some 20 odd minutes before it actually had, because they jumped ahead a bit in the script. It's the same mainstream media that's giving you all these inflated false death and infection figures for COVID-19, and yet people are still believing them even after all these lies. So I equate it to, if you had a confidence trickster that knocked on your front door and asked you to invest £100 in this new amazing scheme that he's got, and you can get rich really quick, and you take him at his word and you say, oh, okay, mate, here's £100, and he clears off with the £100 and you never hear from him again. If that same guy, 1 year later, comes knocking on your door and says, I've got a great investment scheme, all you've got to do is give me £100. Are you going to go, okay, here's £100? Or are you going to go, you've been here before, you're a con artist, you're a thief, get gone, I'm not listening to a word you say. And yet when you equate that situation to the media, people are prepared to give them second chances again and again and again. And they also believe all the lies that come out of the mouths of these government ministers. And believe it or not, there are still people who are actually of the belief that the government cares about us, and all this virus narrative is about keeping us safe because they care. You know, Matt Hancock is just less of the ham. He's a lovely guy and he just cares about us and wants to keep us all safe. You know, you can see it in his eyes. So all these traitors in the mainstream media, they belong in jail, along with Boris Johnson, along with Matt Hancock, less of the ham, Chris Whitty, Neil Ferguson, Bill Gates, Anthony Fauci, and the rest of these traitors to humanity.
So that's Mark Devlin there speaking in Castle Park here in Bristol at the Stand Up Bristol protest. You know, he is going into all sorts of things there, Martin, but one of these things I think, you know, keeps going, it's unstoppable, is the basic facts around 9/11 are a massive lie that was told to the public through the mainstream press. Jane Stanley, you know, this whole idea that the BBC can, or through BBC World, be telling you that a building, building 7, has collapsed half an hour or so before it actually did. It's clear that they're operating to a script. This is not them reporting on events. There is a script that they're following. So really, this is theatre. It's not news.
Well, what happened in that particular case is, I believe that the journalist was told that the building was going to collapse, and therefore she said, "Okay, I'll be, you know, the building has collapsed." I don't think the BBC were in on it as such. I think that they were basically not doing
job. They're getting, I believe it was from Reuters that the release came.
Exactly. So in other words, everybody's repeating hearsay without checking it. And of course, in her particular case, it was particularly poignant because the building she claimed had collapsed was actually behind her in the shot. And it certainly hadn't
collapsed. So it does suggest that the whole thing was deliberate and following a script on that.
Well, no, yeah, but I don't think the BBC journalist was in on it. I think that's an exaggeration.
No, but this is the problem, is that the journalists are not questioning what they're seeing.
No, indeed.
So she turns around and points to the, steps back and points to the skyline saying Building 7 has collapsed. And as she puts her hand up pointing to the skyline, there is Building 7.
Well, she
hasn't collapsed.
I don't think she even pointed to it. I think she, in actual fact, she said it had collapsed, but she didn't even realise what
she was
saying.
Well, she just stepped aside so you could see the skyline. And as she stepped aside so you could see the skyline, there's Building 7 that she's said has collapsed.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the way, if you're trying to understand how these psychological and or warfare operations operate, it isn't just that everybody's in on what's going on.
Well, we're not saying
a small
saying
number
she
of
is.
People are in on what's
she's
going
being told,
on. Lots of other people are just going along with what they're told.
She's been
which is
told
not the same
what
thing.
To say, and she's
That's
just
right.
repeating it without
That's
questioning.
Right. And of course, for 9/11 Truth on their website have now got a very good presentation of all the other journalists who were there, 36 of them that day, all saying there have been explosions in the buildings. And Donald Trump, the President of the United States, made a statement, which you can find on YouTube, where he said, I've got news for you, those buildings have been bombed. They've been bombed because they don't collapse like that. And that's what he said. And I'd like to say that for everybody thinking about voting for Donald Trump in the election that's coming up in November, that's what he said on the day. And he was right about that. The buildings were bombed. And they weren't bombed by Al-Qaeda, were they? They were bombed by the US security forces, and somebody has to pay. And it's got to, that's where we're going. And of course,
well, it may be private interests in the
well,
US, mightn't it?
No, because nanothermite was found in the dust by Nils Harrit and Steve Jones, who are chemists, and it was all reviewed through all of the chemistry journals. In other words, who's got nanothermite? The only people with nanothermite are the US security forces. They killed those people so that they could set off for a war in a foreign country, which is every bit as bad as anything done by the Nazis.
Well, this doesn't actually benefit the US. Surely it only benefits Israel.
The Israelis and the US ruling class are embedded with each other. Jared Kushner, who's married to Ivanka Trump, is a orthodox.
And what about the Brits?
The Brits are in the game as well, no doubt about it. And the question this is what we're up against. At the same time, there's a problem because of all the lies that have been told. People wake up and they start questioning what's going on. But then, of course, they can be equally easily bamboozled because they.
Well, you end up, don't you, in the world of David Icke, where everything is a lie.
Indeed. And therefore, but the problem with all of this, as the philosopher Wittgenstein pointed out years ago, is that the problem is that everybody thinks that they and they alone have seen through the lies. So he used to say the Marxists think it's all about money. The Freudians think it's all about sex. He seems to think it's all about the media. And in actual fact, the way in which these things are actually done is very, very complex and very cleverly
well, what
thought
we try
through.
And do is we try and go through all of those various different questions and answer each one in turn. And I would always at this point recommend a book by David Southwell, which is called Secrets and Lies, where every page has got a different, what you might just call a conspiracy of some sort, and he picks it apart and he gives you all the information that you need to figure out whether it's true or not. And that is what we try and do on this program every week.
Well, I think that's right, Tony, because the danger is that having seen through the mainstream lies, people then are easily basically fooled by non-mainstream lies. And in actual fact, getting to the bottom of things requires a great deal of effort.
Well,
it's not that easy.
Well, that's what we try and do. But of course, this is part of a psychological operation. And we see the mainstream press doing this all the time, is to mix up the truth and the lies. The idea being to just kind of bamboozle and confuse the viewers and the listeners.
Well, you mentioned earlier, and I think we're going to hear from William Cooper. I mean, you've got, Alex Jones, who was very much in favour of the idea that 9/11 was an inside job, and he was even congratulated to helping to get Donald Trump elected, because Donald Trump seemed to think that 9/11 was an inside job. But of course, Alex Jones fundamentally, it looks like, is working for Israeli intelligence, and so therefore all the people that went along with the 9/11 truth stuff, he then starts feeding them a lot of
nonsense. InfoWars popped up in 1999, just before the demise of Bill Cooper. So anyway, let's hear now from the genuine version that Alex Jones is like a doppelganger of Bill Cooper, former Naval Intelligence Officer. And this is his program that he put out on June the 28th, 2001. This isn't the whole thing. This is just a 7-minute extract from it, where he talks very clearly about the prediction that Osama bin Laden is going to be blamed for a massive attack on the United States. And that was this is 2 months before the attack took place, just over 2 months.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening once again to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, have you been paying attention to the news lately? After the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, we were bombarded with anti-patriot, anti-militia, anti-constitutionalists. That's people who believe in the Constitution for the United States of America. Anti-American propaganda. And then when the execution of Timothy McVeigh occurred, once again, prior to and immediately following, the same thing occurred again, and this word extremist was used over and 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 over again. And now we're being bombarded with messages that Osama bin Laden is planning to attack the United States of America and Israel. And I'm telling you, be prepared for a major attack. But it won't be Osama bin Laden. It will be those behind the New World Order who once again want to take the guns and the freedom away from the American people, because we're the only ones left in the world who can oppose the destruction of freedom in the world and the implementation of a one-world totalitarian government, and that is the goal. Now, how stupid can you be to believe that Timothy McVeigh was the mastermind of the destruction of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, and just he and Terry Nichols, who appears to be somewhat of a fool, plotted, planned, obtained all the different materials, put together a bomb of such force that it brought down what we call in the military a hard target, a target held up by steel reinforced concrete columns, and he had no help. No help. The feds never looked for John Doe number 2. In fact, they ordered their agents not to look for him and sent out instructions to all police departments and agencies that there was no John Doe number 2, that Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols were the only participants in the bombing, and not to look for anybody else. How about that? They're doing the same thing today with Osama bin Laden, and that's where I've been getting at. Can you believe what you have been seeing on CNN today, ladies and gentlemen? Can you believe it? Supposedly, a CNN reporter found Osama bin Laden, took a television camera crew with him, went into Osama bin Laden's house, interviewed him and his top leadership, his top lieutenants and colonels and generals in their hideout. This is a CNN reporter with a camera crew. And he came out and told everybody, within 3 weeks, Osama bin Laden is going to attack the United States and Israel.
Now, don't you think that's kind of strange, folks? You see, because the largest intelligence apparatus in the world, with the biggest budget in the history of the world, has been looking for Osama bin Laden for years and years and years, and can't find him. The FBI also, under the leadership of Louis Free, has been looking for Osama bin Laden for years and years and years and years and years and many years, and can't find him. Some doofus, jerk-off reporter with a camera crew waltzes right into his hideout and interviews him. And you know what his budget is? Zip, zilch, nothing. Now, that tells us two things. Either everyone in the intelligence community and all of the intelligence agencies of the United States government are blithering idiots and incompetent fools, including the entire apparatus of the FBI and all of their personnel, or they're lying to us. They're not looking for him at all. And the second is the truth. You see, the CIA created Osama bin Laden. They recruited him. They trained him. They found his leadership. They brought them all together. They showed them how to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And when that was over, they still continued to fund him and train him, and they're now using him to help bring about world government by making him the big boogeyman because they can't use Saddam Hussein anymore. Did you ever hear of Osama bin Laden before you heard of Saddam Hussein? When did you start hearing of Osama bin Laden? It was after Saddam Hussein and Iraq were supposedly neutralized in the Gulf War, because they needed a new boogeyman. But they're not looking for Osama bin Laden, because I'm telling you right now, if I were the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, within 2 weeks I would have him dead or in custody without fail, without fail. If I had those assets and that money, he would be mine. I would own his terrorist ass within 2 weeks without fail. A reporter from CNN and his little camera crew got in to Osama bin Laden's secret hideout and conducted an interview. If you don't believe me, tune into CNN. They're probably running it right now as I'm speaking. And if you believe it, you are one of the stupidest jerks that ever lived on the face of this earth. And whatever is going to happen that they're going to blame on Osama bin Laden, don't you even believe it. Another social engineering project to change the minds and the attitudes and the beliefs of the people of the world, and especially the United States, to bring about one world socialist totalitarian government.
So that's Sir William Cooper speaking on the 28th of June, 2001. He did get something wrong, Martin. He said that the CNN and the rest of them were saying that there might be some sort of attack. They were worried in mid-July. It didn't happen in mid-July. It happened about another month after that, didn't it? But I think it's pretty amazing. His analysis there is making it absolutely clear that Osama bin Laden is being prepared, pre-prepared, in public, on the television, so that everyone knows who he is when 9/11 happens.
Yeah, I mean, basically, he's obviously got some inside knowledge because he's an ex-naval intelligence guy. And
but he's making a very basic point, isn't he? He's saying, well, hang on a minute. If this guy's really being sought by the CIA, then there's no way that a CNN camera crew can find him, but the CIA can't. It's a basic bit of logic he's pointing out, which actually tears the whole lie of that CNN story and the CIA story to pieces.
Yeah, and you know, he obviously didn't have inside knowledge of what the targets was going to be. But I mean, basically, he's pretty correct. I mean, the official story is that Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden used to work for the CIA, MI6, and they were armed and trained and directed with Saudi money to fight the Red Army in Afghanistan. But glory be, they changed direction. They suddenly bit the hand that fed them and started bombing in Kenya and elsewhere and so on. And of course, Robert Fisk, who's a much more credible journalist in my view than William Cooper, he interviewed Osama bin Laden, and he was basically told that, you know, that he'd changed his mind, and the reason Osama bin Laden had, you know, in other words, we were being prepared in advance for Osama bin Laden to be, you know, Emmanuel Bronstein, as in 1984.
Do you want to do a prediction to say what you think is going to happen in the future? I mean, particularly one of the things we know that's coming on the horizon at the moment is a bit of educated guesswork, really, about this global reset, because it does seem as if there's got to be some kind of economic collapse of some kind for them to justify bringing a kind of basic complete replacement for the IMF.
Well, I mean, this is a bigger question. The mainstream are talking about the Green New Deal and the Great Reset. Now, in actual fact, even if there wasn't any conspiracies going on, capitalism is running up against the wall. It's about to collapse. They know that, and they're preparing for the follow-on. And of course, the follow-on isn't going to be totalitarian world socialist government. It's going to be World War III, which is going to pit the Russian military and the Chinese military against the Western and Israeli military.
Isn't the whole point of that World War III to create such trauma that the world agrees that we need some kind of world government?
Well, what may well happen if the right people win is we will have some kind of world government, but most likely, more likely than anything else, is we're just going to see a collapse of civilization. There isn't going to be a great reset. There's going to be a great collapse.
Well, the spark for all of this does certainly seem to be, potentially anyway, in the Middle East between Iran and Israel. I wonder, you know, the false flag seems to be the favoured method, but I wonder, do you think it's feasible to have something like, I mean, we've seen these chemical weapons attacks which haven't been successful, to have something so audacious as a nuclear false flag? We were talking last week, weren't we, about missing nuclear weapons, stuff being sold on the black market, nuclear weapons on the black market.
Well, you could, the could be some kind of nuclear attack, either false flag or direct. That's definitely possible. People have got to realise we came very, very close to nuclear war in 1983. The buttons were just about to be pressed, and then they weren't. And of course, this is the point about the what's happened with the getting out the INF treaty and so on, is that both the Russians and the Chinese are very aware that a first strike is being planned against
them. But with a totalitarian type of a system happening to then come in, obviously under wartime, even worse than what we've happened to deal with under COVID, one of the, and you've pointed this out yourself, that 5G could actually be something which is enables effective kind of drone policing to go on within our cities. Now, that's another aspect to all of this which hasn't really been touched on, the fact that 5G is actually a military system as well as a nice telecom system for downloading things on your phone or whatever. It's also a military system, as Thierry Masson and others have pointed out.
Well, that's right. I mean, basically, all of these technologies are dual use. They've got some civilian uses, and they've also got military uses.
Anyway,
which is why the Chinese have been developing them, and why the Americans are starting to panic, because the Chinese seem to be ahead.
Anyway, before we have a listen to David Livingstone, the final item, I thought it'd be interesting to listen to the retired president of Microsoft Canada, Frank Clegg, because he's come out as a anti-5G person, and he should know, having been at the centre, it might be that the Canadian anti-5G campaign is going to get a bit of a financial boost with people like him on side. And what irritates me more than anything else, Martin, is that the mainstream press, we don't hear anything from Frank Clegg, the retired president of Microsoft, about why 5G might be dangerous. All we get is that, oh, all these nutty anti-5G campaigners, they're all David Icke supporters, or that they're basically insane. There is a very, very definite argument, for example, against the vaccines. You can have a reasoned argument against those, but you can also have a very reasoned argument against 5G, but that's being denied by the mass media.
Well, what goes on, of course, is you've got some people like Piers Corbyn who think 5G has got something to do with COVID, and you've got other people who want to mix in things like about you know, the problem is that, some, as I said earlier, people, if you're going to analyse these things, you've got to have a sceptical mind. And the problem is that people criticise some things, but then they start mixing it all up. It's like putting it in a blender and going...
Let me put my journalistic hat on for a minute, which I do occasionally, believe it or not. And that is, we really ought to say, for example, with the COVID-19, let's have a discussion and debate between Bill Gates and Andrew Wakefield, between two opposed experts in the field. And that's, to me, what journalism should be about. So anyway, so I'm going to let you listen now to someone you will not have heard of at all, I would imagine.
On the
BBC.
Oh, no,
Frank Clegg. Okay. From Frank Clegg, who's he's a technological expert. He's the former president of Microsoft Canada, and here he is warning us about 5G.
Hello, my name is Frank Clegg, and I spent over 40 years in the technology sector. My most recent position is a president of Microsoft Canada. In my career, I've seen the tremendous benefit that technology can provide. I've also seen the potential harm if technology is not implemented correctly. 5G technology has not been tested. I am not aware of a single study that shows that 5G technology is safe. 5G, as in all other wireless technology, gives off radio frequency radiation, which is absorbed in the human body and accumulates in the human body. One segment of 5G technology are millimeter waves. Millimeter waves are used by the US and Israeli government in their active denial systems, which are used for crowd control. And what they do is they provide a very painful reaction in the skin organs of the body. We have no idea what the impacts will be to human health if that kind of millimeter wave technology is used and we are exposed to it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There are significant proven health effects from wireless technology and wireless devices. These include insomnia, headaches, fatigue, heart palpitations, all caused by exposure to wireless devices and the radiation from them. More serious symptoms and conditions include heart arrhythmia, infertility, tinnitus, numbness or tingling in the extremities, diabetes, cancer, and permanent DNA damage. Mental health is also impacted, with increased anxiety, depression, rises in ADHD and autism, mood swings, and emotional instability. In fact, all of these health factors and conditions have risen exponentially over the last 30 years, and hundreds of studies that show proof of biological harm from wireless devices. Most recently, in 2018, the National Institute of Health's National Toxicology Program released the findings of a 14-year, $25 million study that showed clear evidence of harm in terms of cancer and permanent DNA damage. This study, several months later, was verified by the prestigious Ramazzini Institute out of Italy, which found the same results. Now, you may ask how a product that has this potential harm could ever be released to the market and to the public for public use. Well, the way the process works is the FCC regulates all wireless devices and products associated with them. Unfortunately, the FCC is made up of previous telecom executives, lawyers, and engineers. It does not have any scientists or doctors that you would expect to be involved with the regulation of potentially harmful products. In fact, the FCC guidelines are 20 years out of date without any major significant improvement.
So that's Frank Clegg, former, he was retired president of Microsoft Canada. I mean, Martin, he's saying there that we've got enormous amounts of proof of biological harm, and yet people who are campaigning to stop 5G masks and things like that are basically called lunatics. So we are being gaslighted by both the government, the industry, and by the mainstream press on 5G.
Well, I mean, I hear with interest what he has to say, because he's got the technological background to make a serious case. I'm open-minded about this. I think it's quite likely that what tends to happen in any case, even with relatively harmless technologies, is that if there's money to be made or there's a military advantage to be achieved, then they're going to go ahead with it. The same thing was true of radar during World War II. They knew at the time that people who were operating radar stations were going to be very seriously affected by it. But at the time, the issue was defeating Hitler, and so they didn't bother to retaliate.
Isn't this really about the regulation? I mean, he's talking there about the FCC, but in Europe and other parts of the world is this organisation called ICNIRP, I-C-N-R-P, which is there was a report by two MEPs a couple of months ago that said, well, actually, these are basically just industry people on this body, so they're regulating themselves. There is no regulation. Let's just be frank about it. There isn't any proper regulation at all.
Well, it's what it is what's called regulatory capture in economics textbooks. But of course, I'm trying to stress the military applications of this. This is one of the reasons why they're going to cut corners. The same reason why they injected loads of flu virus into soldiers in Kansas before they set off to go and fight on the Western Front in World War One. They weren't wasting time carrying out proper tests to try and see whether it was safe or not. They were cutting corners for military reasons. And I think that you've probably got the same sort of thing going on. If the Chinese are getting ahead on 5G, as they seem to be, for both commercial and military reasons, then you have got to compete with them and develop the same sort of technology.
So if you're bringing in a military technology which hasn't been tested and there's proof that it's biologically harmful, this can only be called evil, really.
Well, the problem is, if somebody else is doing it, and your enemies, if you don't do it, they're going to beat you in the coming war. And therefore, the pressure on everybody is to cut corners and with all the consequences that we know. I mean, in actual fact, the military-industrial complexes of the world, plus the commercial desires of the backers of these kinds of new technology, override human welfare every time,
well,
don't they?
Believe it or not, there was a time when the mainstream media took evil seriously, and here is a clip we're going to hear now from ABC, the Australian program 60 Minutes, from a film called The Servants of Satan, which was removed from my YouTube channel by YouTube a few weeks ago. And here is just the opening lines of that documentary, where they're looking at satanic ritual abuse.
Friends of family and strangers and my family used to rape me, make me abort the babies I had.
It would be hard to imagine more misery and suffering than what Teresa says she's had to endure.
And us kids would be made to do things with the adults and the animals, and then a sacrifice would happen.
The sacrifice? Were these animal sacrifices?
Animals and people.
On what scale do you think this was happening?
Enormous. Far beyond what we've ever heard of here before.
Teresa's mother, Bridget.
You're talking about mass murder?
Yes. On a scale that this country's never heard of before.
Like the old people's homes now, I mean, there's a...
For the first time, Teresa is learning what it's like to live with love instead of fear.
Pretty low.
In this quiet English village, with the help of her mother, she's slowly repairing her broken life. Teresa is now 15, but at the age of 2, she was left in the care of this woman, the grandma she called Nan. And that, she says, is when her torment started.
Who was the leader? Who was the boss of the gang, of the cult?
At home, it was my Nan.
So that's a clip from the ABC Australian documentary 60 Minutes, in the opening clip, actually. The title of the documentary was Servants of Satan. That was released in 1989, a documentary about satanic ritual abuse recorded here in the UK. Martin, often you find that countries find it very difficult, their own media, to actually do documentaries about difficult things going on in their own countries. So I guess that's why the Australians came to Britain to do it. You know, that would have been a very difficult film to make in Britain. We had a similar situation with the Conspiracy of Silence documentary, which was made for US TV, actually by Yorkshire Television. So to actually make a film about this kind of evil going on in your own country is almost impossible. You've got to go and at the very least make it in another country. But now, you know, this is, we're talking about now 30 years on from when that documentary was made. It's almost impossible to do at all.
Well, I mean, the allegations are being made all the time, and the mainstream media, as we know, is dominated by vested interests, and therefore people get a very distorted view of how the world works.
I remember Tim Tate talking about the conspiracy of silence on this programme, the documentary he made about child sexual abuse in the United States and the use of it for blackmailing politicians, saying that he was paid, or him and his team were paid $500,000 by the Discovery Channel for the documentary they've made, which was then never broadcast.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have not looked into this in any detail, so I'm willing to listen to any kind of argument from any perspective about any of it. But you can't presume that just because somebody's made a film or a documentary or run a radio show, that that's the end of the argument in any shape or form.
Well, no one's saying it's the end, Martin. What I'm saying is that these kinds of documentaries are just not made at all now. In fact, even magazines like Private Eye poo-poo the idea that there could even be such a thing as satanic ritual abuse.
Well, one of the things I'd say about this, Tony, is I'm a political activist and I try and concentrate on political matters. And the problem with mixing everything all up in a blender...
Well, that's not what we're doing here. We're talking specifically about satanic ritual abuse and evil.
Yeah, well, you're mentioning evil. That's okay. We can mention it. I'm very aware that the Western intelligence services, and probably not just them, have used child abuse as a blackmail tool. At Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, for example, it's well understood across the political spectrum what happened.
Well, this
there.
Amazingly sort of provides us, in a way, with a motivation, doesn't it, to do these things? I mean, people
That's
would
right.
think, well, surely no one would do that, but actually there can be enormous political gains from doing it.
Well, yes, there's a very there's means, motive, and opportunity. And we certainly know that they do use these kind of mechanisms.
Okay,
and,
so...
But individual allegations have to be individually looked at. You can't just presume in a blanket way that we know exactly what's going on. Because, of course, we don't.
We're putting bits of the jigsaw together. And I suppose looking at this in the light of the fact that, that no one is really able to make programmes like this anymore, certainly not for the mainstream press. And just it's just amazing, I think, listening to that 1989 documentary. Certainly for people now, they would never see something like that on television. But back in 1989, it did. It was ran out on 60 Minutes all over Australia. So we'll finish tonight with this clip from David Livingston. The longer interview he did is called The Occult Empire, the goals of that, and it's called Order from Chaos. His book is The Dying God, and this is what he's got to say about the evil he believes is that out there in the world today, and the actual motivation, I suppose, around chaos and madness to bring about a one-world totalitarian government. I mean, that's what he calls it, not a socialist government, as William Cooper does, just simply a totalitarian global system.
If we want to understand what is the Quran teaching us when it teaches us that the devil is out to destroy us, what does that look like? So what do we need to look out for? What it seems to look like is that this long-term plan, which has started out with the Magi, with Neoplatonism, with the Sufis, the Brethren of Sincerity, with the Templars, the Rosicrucians, the Masons, has been this slow growth of this underground occult movement, which has gained momentum and finally succeeded in 1776 and 1789 in the American and French revolutions, and basically the first occult orders that were created in the world. And they are using those as the vanguard to advance this plan, which is what Albert Pike calls the magnum opus, which is to fulfill the book of Revelation, to construct the third temple, which is supposed to herald the arrival, I guess the Messiah is supposed to come and build the third temple. So this expected Messiah is clearly the Dajjal. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They are working towards bringing about the arrival of the Dajjal. In fact, the whole point of Kabbalah...
He's talking about
Kabbalah
Dajjal here, which is the Muslim equivalent of the Antichrist.
The particularity of the Kabbalah of Isaac Luria from the 1500s, who explained, and this all Kabbalah since is based on his version, is that you don't sit around and wait for the Messiah. You have to actively work to bring about his arrival. So this is what order out of chaos means, order out of chaos. That if the conditions described in the book of Revelation and other prophecies describe chaos preceding the arrival of this Messiah, then of course you, in their understanding, you have to sow chaos. So if there's supposed to be wars, deception, famine, destruction, then you have to create those events because they will herald, and this is the Luciferian version. So and this is what Dugin says. So Dugin says in his own words that the book of Revelation is not so much a prophecy, it's a task. So these are Luciferians who relish chaos. They believe that good is found in destruction, in mayhem, in blood, in suffering. You know, the satanic ritual is, you know, I'm sorry to say, but a satanic ritual often involves the slaughter of a child, the slaughter of a baby, right? I mean, so for them, that kind of horror gets them excited, right? They've gone over to the dark side. They feel that they have the psychological fortitude to be able to handle it, and they get sucked into it. And so that kind of violence, it makes them feel like they are powerful. So they will basically hold back no lengths that they will go to of the kind of mayhem and destruction that they will create in order to sow the chaos that they believe is necessary to create the preconditions for the arrival of the Messiah.
So he's calling it the Messiah. Some will call it the Antichrist or the Dajjal in the Islam. You just heard there from David Livingstone. He's the author of The Dying God, also the book Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, which I would thoroughly recommend, which really describes this kind of modern fascism, the idea that you can use computers and technology to engineer humanity in whichever way you wish. And what we're seeing, I think, a lot with the idea of these ID passports, that kind of thing. So, time to sign off. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. It was Lib Dem councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Thanks also to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and studio engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s, listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Sunday evenings at 6 on BCFM with Danny Lopsch, and even on Sunday lunchtime at noon on the Richie Allen channel. You can get that at richieallen.co.uk. Apparently, we're broadcasting our show every week from Sunday. So do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday, where we'll be joined by Republican Labour activist Martin Summers again. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Baby, I can pay you to a kiss. There is so much a man can tell me, so much he can say. You remain my power, my pleasure, my pain. To me you're like a grown addiction that I can't deny. Now won't you tell me he's a healthy baby? But did you know that when it snows, my eyes become a large and the light that you shine can't be seen.